Okay, thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the second day of meeting of the 95th public meeting of the Diego Canon Independent Safety Committee. This is the second day of our public meeting. The first item on our agenda would be for committee members making remarks. Dr. Butners, Dr. Peterson, there being no remark from the committee member, the next item would be an opportunity for public comments on items not on our agenda. Members of the public who wishes to address the committee about their concerns outside of our agenda items, please come forward.
Thank you. I'm Sherry Lewis of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And I'm wondering about the casks, that the design of the casks and how they will be chosen and all for PG&E in the future. My understanding is that you actually will have no input in the design of the cask. Is that correct?
The design of the casks, that's correct. They're designed by expert manufacturing companies.
But then in the choosing of the casks, would you have any input in that?
You mean the selection amongst several possibilities?
Yeah.
I don't know. They will be allowing us to review some of that, but we don't know at what stage or what influence or what, I don't think. Anybody else want to comment about that?
Well, I think basically we've discussed this topic before. The most important point is that at Diablo Canyon there's an existing independent fuel storage installation which is designed to accept a specific type of storage cask that bolts down. To go to a different type of overpack design would be expensive and time-consuming in the sense that the independent fuel storage facility is built on a rock unit that is contiguous to the plant and therefore is enveloped by the plant seismic analysis. There's not another place to stick another pad where you'd be able to do that. Moreover, the licensing process to get to that single pad and construct it was almost a decade. If your goal is to meet the current schedule for getting spent fuel out of the spent fuel pool, practically speaking, you have to have a dry storage system that would work with the existing independent spent fuel storage installation foundation and stuff. So I think that the most likely changes that we would end up seeing would be potentially substantial modifications to the existing canister and cask design introduce improvements. But you're not going to see a completely different system adopted because that would take such a long period of time that it would cause a serious delay in being able to offload the spent fuel from the spent fuel pools.
Moreover, well, they're already delaying that anyway.
Yes. Well, it would be an additional delay. Moreover, there's already a large number of existing storage canisters on that pad. And if you wanted to change all of them over to a different design, that would be a major undertaking to bring them all back, unload them, reload into a different design. And so the risk profile posed by that facility is set by the existing canisters because it's very unlikely that it would be practical that you'd want to try to change them. And so the additional modifications that one would implement for the new canisters, I think it would be our consensus that the most valuable things you could do in updating the design and modifying the license would be to license them to take somewhat fresher fuel so that you could expedite the remaining work for offloading the spent fuel pool.
So apparently this would all be through Holtec then, who does the original cask.
It would be very difficult for any other vendor, but of course PG&E is working with other vendors to determine what their options would be that they could provide. Because of course it is feasible to take that existing facility and install a different vendor's type of cask system there.
As long as it fit the ISFISI.
That's correct. And you might not, I mean, it's a nice big concrete pad. So you could put various different things there. And PG&E is a part of its overall effort to review and update and identify new designs, both from the Holtec but also from other vendors, is essentially doing its due diligence to make sure that it has explored all possible options. But in the end, I don't think that an option that would cause, that would force a substantial delay in getting spent fuel out of the spent fuel pool would be worth the incremental cost and effort. But I do think that updated designs to go on the same pad, particularly that might enable a faster offloading and closure of the spent fuel pools, could be merited. And we will be reviewing all of that. And if there's any safety issues with the modified designs that we'd identify, of course, we would bring those up and provide recommendations.
So it's stable, like the high burn of fuel.
But we have a safety remit, and let's imagine that there are four contenders. I'm just making this up. And that we have a chance to review those before a decision is made. If they all have a comparable safety performance, we would say that. But we're not in a position to, nor would we, extend any recommendations beyond that statement. For example, if one of them was simply cheaper, we don't care about that. I mean, we care about it because we're taxpayers and ratepayers. But it's not part of our committee's charge, okay? If one of them could be manufactured to get here 7 days earlier, we don't care about that. If their safety is comparable. See, it might be 7 years earlier. Right. We're still not supposed to care about that. We're a safety committee.
See, we were thinking of thicker canisters and either a berm.
Yes, or I understand a fully. Around. That's right.
Any but, chance that a building could be put around that?
We don't know. It's for them to decide. And it's for us to evaluate its safety if they decided it.
Now, Ms. Lewis, may I offer you some material and information? I hope that would be useful to you in your inquiry. You know, you asked, you know, whether or not this committee will be involved. But let me share with you some background information. The impetus, as I indicated earlier in this meeting yesterday, the impetus for a new CAS design is not driven by safety consideration per se. I mean, it may result in enhanced or improved safety performance characteristics, but that was not the impetus of this current push for a new design. Our political leaders in Sacramento, vis-a-vis the Public Utility Commission and the Energy Commission, make the inquiry to the licensee here whether or not they are able to have a cast removal schedule from wet storage to dry storage consistent with what has been planned in St. Onofre. More specifically, St. Onofre claim or asserted they could move cast after 5 years of residency period. So that result in a removal schedule. So our political leaders in Sacramento now say, gee, why are you at the Able Cannon not doing the same thing with the presumption that wet storage perhaps is less desirable than dry storage? In response, in a Public Utility Commission submittal, the licensee put forward a couple of scenarios, one of which is, yes, indeed, we would be able to do it with a more expedited schedule relative to the existing schedule if we had a new cast design. Okay? Now, that new cast design turned out to be to be a lot more time-consuming than what was proposed in that submittal. Now, I was aware of that submittal because the then chairman of the Energy Commission had a conversation with me about, gee, what is your opinion? Now, the reason I was asked because I was sitting on the licensing board 25 years ago, which approved the existing dry gas storage system here. So I had a little bit of knowledge about what the existing gas, on what basis was it approved. Then the inquiry was really twofold from everybody involved. How realistically is the proposed schedule in Diablo Canyon's proposal to the California Public Utility Commission in realizing a new CAS design to go through licensing? Now, on a technical basis, also, how would the new CAS be different than the old CAS? To the first question was, well, the old licensing effort took about 5 to 6 years of extensive scrutiny. I'm sure your organization was a participant in that legal proceeding. But for the new one, the response would be, well, this is a new CAS design. There's now a known phenomenon for failure for the existing CAS, which is stress corrosion cracking. So the response would be, at the time of the old design, this failure was not known and not knowable. Knowing what we know today, the licensing arena may be a very different landscape. It's difficult to predict what the schedule looked like. The answer to the second inquiry was the new design, by definition, would have to be more thermally advanced in the respect that it can take a lot more heat thermally.
Because
otherwise,
of the high burnup
agenda of expedited removal.
I have because of high burnup the fuel, or because they wanted to offload it sooner.
Both. Yeah. You know. So I mean that's why the request for proposal had taken almost 2 years to prepare. It is not ready to be issued yet.
So were you saying that the original designs were showing signs of corrosion? Did you say that?
There has been some observation of the whole CAS has stress corrosion cracking. Uh-huh. And Ms. Donna Gilmore is a proponent of that issue in front of all the regulatory agencies. Right. And she hasn't spoken about this in front of this committee. But so your inquiry with that background, I hope that would be helpful. Well, to what extent this company would be involved?
Well, it shows me that they decided they needed to come up with a new design for the two reasons. One was their stress fractures, and so it needs to be better. And the other is they wanted to offload it sooner and maybe all at once rather than start earlier and begin. Yeah. I mean, they could offload things now, but they don't have the casks.
Right. We are not privy to what the request for proposal look like. So the answer to your question is probably would involve both factors, probably. I'm sure they would involve the second factor of expedited removal. Would it be more immune to the latest known failure phenomena? I do not know because I haven't seen the request for proposal.
Yeah, I can add a little bit more on that. They've switched to using 316L type of stainless steel from 304, and it has better characteristics with respect to welding and cracking. With respect to high burn up, the key concern with the high burn-up fuel, it involves the drying process. And so other vendors than Holtec have used a vacuum drying process. So after you've, in the pool, you put the fuel assemblies into the canister, you put a lid on, you seal that lid, and then at that point you pump out the water.
Yeah.
and you dry the fuel. And the way that you dry it out for other vendors has been to pull a vacuum and essentially vacuum dry the fuel. The issue is that with vacuum, heat transfer is very, very poor, and therefore fuel rods will reach temperatures that are substantially higher than they ever experienced when they were in service and can experience hydrating.
Well, why don't they just leave the water in there?
I'm going to have to just kind of break in here for a minute. Yeah. We're getting dangerously close to more information because this is a time for brief comment.
That's correct.
If somebody wanted to hear this presentation, then it really should be on our agenda.
And we've discussed these topics before. They are definitely in the record of discussion for this committee. But I think that Bob Rathe is correct. At this point, we're going into more detail than.
Could you answer that last thing though about the water? Why can't they just leave the water in?
Water will cause corrosion. It provides oxygen and such. So you want to dry out the fuel and backfill with inert gas, which is helium.
Yeah.
The Holtec process purges with helium and dries using helium, and so the fuel is never exposed to temperatures that are any greater than what it experienced in the reactor, and therefore there's no damage caused by this hydrating process that can occur at very high temperature. So embrittlement of the cladding, there's no embrittled cladding from that vacuum drying process here at Diablo Canyon.
When you use helium.
Southern California Edison, some of their fuel did get dried that way, and so has that issue.
Thank you very much.
Additional public comments on item not on our agenda? There being none, let's move to the next item on the agenda, which will be informational presentations requested by the committee of PG&E. Now let me turn the podium over to Mr. Tom Barvin, the Director of Business Planning.
Thank you, Dr. Lam. First up, we have Mr. Hussein Hamzi with more than 35 years experience in the nuclear power industry, including 17 in leadership positions with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Mr. Hussein runs our nuclear regulatory interactions and relationship. His team manages the NRC's inspections, and they also support the on-site NRC resident inspectors that overlook everything we do day in, day out to ensure that our operations are run and performed safely. Mr. Hamzi has a master's degree in mechanical engineering from CSU Long Beach and is a registered professional engineer. He's going to tell us about what the NRC has fed back to us in terms of our performance since we last met. Hussein?
Welcome.
Thank you, Tom, and glad to be here again. Am I audible here? I can't.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So good to be here again. And so we're here again. I would like now to cover the Diablo Canyon's performance based on the NRC performance indicators. And this reporting period covers the October of 2019 through January of 2020. And so this presentation and results cover about 4 months, which is approximately around 1,800 hours of the NRC inspection time. And during this performance period, the Diablo Canyon has met the green performance expectation for all the NRC performance indicators. During this period, we had issued a one licensee event report, and I will talk about it in a little more detail. And the NRC has identified 4 very low safety significant violations during this period. If there are no questions, I'll go to the next one. Good, you're going to do this. So again, I would like to quickly summarize what the NRC performance indicators are. As you see, there are about 16 performance indicators that they covered a wide spectrum of the licensee's performance. They are, as you see, anywhere from unplanned scrams per 7,000 critical hours to safety system functional failures, mitigating system performance, all the way to reactivity, ERO, drill expectations, and alert and notification. And as you see, for units 1 and 2, they're both all green during this performance period. So I would like now to go ahead and quickly summarize the four very low safety significant violations that we received during this performance period. The first one is a non-sited violation, green, which means, again, it's a very low safety significance. And this is regarding a fire barrier seal that was found to be outside our design configuration. And what happened was in September of last year, during a walkdown of Unit 2, vital for KV switchgear rooms, we found a fire boundary gap that was not sealed properly. And that degraded condition was evaluated, and the results indicated that the fire barrier was still functional and could have performed its function during any potential fire. And the NRC assigned the cross-cutting aspect of Hotel 7 to this, which is the documentation. So even though this was functional, there were no performance functionality issues, but they found that this should have been documented in our surveillance results and testing of these configurations. If there are no questions, I'll go to the next one. The next non-sited violation, again, was green, very low safety significance. And what happened, again, during the last Unit 2 refueling outage in September of last year, we were walking down the systems, also with some of the NRC staff that were doing the same thing, we found painting on some of these fire sprinklers. And there were a number of them. So we noted those, went back, evaluated those painting to make sure that they had no impact on the functionality of the sprinklers. And the results were that, yes, there were just some minor paint on them, and they were all functional.
You mean the paint did not interfere with the sprinkler's capability to spray water?
Correct.
Right. I'm just curious, what part of the fire sprinkler system had paint on it? Was it the piping or the actual spray valve?
The actual sprinkler, but not on the spray, on the body of the sprinklers. In other words, there's some guidelines that say if there is any paint or any objects that would either prevent the spray or the direction of the flow, then that could be problematic. But these paints were very minor and did not impact
the actual function or operability.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay.
So there's no paint on the nozzles.
Correct. Yes. Okay. So now, why is it a violation? Well, if you go back and look at the National Fire NFPA standards, there are some criteria that say that's okay. But because at Diablo we had our internal procedure that says no paint should be on any of these sprinklers, so we did not follow our own procedural guidance. And as a result, the NRC gave us a very low safety significant violation, non-sited. And again, for this, they assigned a cross-cutting aspect of Hotel 1. They called it resources. So, all right, the next one is another green, very low safety significant non-sited violation, and this was regarding, again, during the last refueling outage for Unit 2, usually that what we do is as we open up the containment, there are some regulatory and internal requirements that we have to test some of these containment penetrations, isolations. So this one is specifically related to our fuel transfer tube quid opening hatch. So this specific one, what we did was when we opened it, there are two conditions. One is as you find it, you have to test to make sure the integrity of penetrations are maintained, the tightness, and there's no containment leakage. So on these ones, there are two ways that we usually test these. One is as found, one is as left. Because these things are usually very reliable and there are no issues, there are industry guidance that says you're okay, you don't have to test them when you open the hatch. But then before you close them, as left condition, you have to test them. So that's what the Diablo Canyon staff did. However, when the NRC looked at this and they reviewed the situation, they said, yes, you could do that, but sometimes you have to do some evaluation to show that there are no previously issues with these penetrations. And for these, you did not do that evaluation. So as a result, we got a violation. And as you see, because this happened a few years ago, there are no cross-cutting aspect assigned to this. Again, there are some industry ASME codes requirements that they allow you just to do as left, not as found. But the catch here is that there should be some evaluation prior to doing that. And this one was, again, a very low safety significance with no impact on public health and safety. And the last one is another very low safety significant finding, and this was related to our reactor coolant pump 2-3, and during as we were doing some venting of the RCP sealed return lines, the RCP 2-3 number 1 seal valve was inadvertently closed, so that isolated the seafloor. So that if it was in that configuration for a long period of time, that could potentially impact the integrity of the seal. So, however, in this situation, it was only in this configuration for less than 15 minutes. So we went back, did some evaluations, Westinghouse looked at it, and it was such a short amount of time that did not have any impact on the functionality and integrity of the seal, and even the temperature rise was less than a couple of degrees. So, however, you know, if this was left for a longer period of time, it could potentially impact the integrity of the seal. So on this one, we have a green finding and with cross-cutting aspect of Hotel 12, which is avoiding complacency.
Now, may I?
Sure,
may
please.
I interrupt? You know, there's no dispute here of your assessment. You know, the return line was isolated for a short time, right? So this assessment is certainly beyond dispute.
Yes.
Right. But my question is, gee, you know, in our business of examining safety, to what extent and to what level of detail should one pursue these very low safety significance events? I mean, this is a question, you know. With your expertise, perhaps you can provide some guidance. If I may give you an example, okay. The Boeing 737 MAX accident had provoked a great deal of scrutiny, okay. There are two sensors on each plane to measure altitude, okay? Now, the Boeing software rely on only one of two sensors. I'm talking about history, okay?
Yes.
Now, immediately that violates our single failure criteria. We don't do business this way. Okay. Now, furthermore, that particular component had a record, according to the FAA, about 450 failures, falling into three categories, each of which was deemed at the time of recording that failure to be minor safety significance. For example, one-third of the failure was due to moisture intrusion to that sensor, because by design, it's open to air.
Yes.
And there's always moisture intrusion, okay? And one-third of it was due to bird strike. For airplane, that's a common occurrence. And then the remaining third was due to the jet bridge impact on the plane, because the sensor that was relied on for the software activation was on the side where the jet bridge would come in. When the jet bridge hit, you know what I'm talking about, the jet bridge, right? It's a walkway. You connect the plane to passenger terminal.
Yes.
So at the time of recording this failure, each one of them was deemed insignificant. But by definition, we go through the same analysis. Yes, you know, one was frozen. Now you couple that with a single failure criterion violation, and also couple that when the software activates, the operator's response time, which is the pilot, is about 15 seconds. And you further couple that with the force to override that inadvertent activation of the sensor require a force about 250 to 500 pounds. Now, it takes quite an effort to do that activation, particularly if you may have a lady pilot sitting next to you.
Yes.
So all this come together and create a perfect storm for accident. And we witnessed two tragedies that way. Right. So to go back to my inquiry, then that component failure, really, it happened 500 times. It led to no disaster. Why should we worry about it? Right. I'm not saying this component of failure or this failure would be in that category. But the question is, with limited resources, how should we handle this type of events and occurrences?
All right. I want to make sure I understand the question before I respond. So your question is whether this has a low safety significance, so we should prioritize to see where the resources should be devoted to more based on the risk significance? Or are you just...
That's one. That's one question. The next one is, should we extend our analysis with limited resources to see whether or not this failure would lead to something else?
More significant,
right,
yeah.
Right,
that's
right.
A,
would,
yeah.
It, would it coexist with some other occurrences? I mean, really, this is a question. I really do not know the answer. I thought maybe you have some thought on that.
Yeah, I have a thought about it. The discipline of probabilistic risk assessment is ideally structured and suited for just such an analysis. It requires two things. It requires that the analyst identify the scenario in detail. This, then this, not that, then this, whatever the scenario is.
Yes.
And that each of those events in the scenario, having been identified, it requires some estimate of the probability or the contingent probability or the likelihood or whatever it happens to be of that event given the preceding things that came before it, which are sometimes contingent on it, and sometimes they're just not contingent on it. They're just, you know, some probability anyway. And for most scenarios like this, we don't have those data in detail, but estimates are reasonably attainable that can tell you whether you're in some sort of a ballpark that matters or not, and then you can go and try to refine your estimate by getting refined data. So I think it's not only not beyond comprehension, it's eminently within our methodology and within our knowledge in terms of the data. That's what I would think.
But we limit the resources. Should we pursue that strategy?
Well, it depends how many resources it takes to work it out. If somebody's intimately familiar with the whole thing, they might take them an hour or two to figure out the scenario and another 10 minutes to put the numbers in, numbers that aren't exact but at least tell you where you are. And if it's 10 to minus 10 per year, you know you don't have to worry. If the numbers come out 10 to minus 3 per year, you better go refine them. Okay? I don't think those things take forever.
Well, but you know,
I don't know what your estimate would be.
Sure, you know, that is certainly a very strategic.
More to the point, PG&E at Diablo Canyon has a group that does this routinely. You know the group well. We hear from them all the time. And they're skilled and among the best in the industry and have a reputation for that. And usually, and they do these analyses all the time, from time to time, on scenarios that nobody thought of before. You know, there'll be some oddball thing that happens, and they do that as a piece of their assigned support for the engineering or the operations or wherever it happens to be. And they end up with some rough estimate. And most of the time, that rough estimate shows it's not significant, and that's okay. And if otherwise, they have to go and refine it.
So you're right, Dr. Bosnick. So let me go back.
I'm not recommending you do that. That's not my position. I'm noting that it is feasible if thought to be important enough.
Yes. So let me go back and try to respond to your questions. I think, Bob, you're right. There's some aspect of that in two different categories. One, as you mentioned, there is a well-known approach in the industry and very mature approach. We call it risk-informed approach.
Right.
So the risk-informed is very broad. We have risk-informed regulations, risk-informed inspections, risk-informed evaluations. So So it's very consistent with what you are saying. And at Diablo, we have already done a number of risk prioritizations of all the SSCs at the plant. And we do actually have a list of a few hundreds of components that are ranked based on their risk importance. Yep. And usually there are two risk parameters, as you know, or risk metrics that we use to prioritize those. One is called core damage frequency, or CDF. One is called LRF, or large early release frequencies. And based on those, then we have the high risk significant systems and components. And then when different applications come, we go back and make sure that we understand what those systems and components are. And that list is not just shared by the PRA team. It's shared by engineering, maintenance, operations. As a matter of fact, you go to control room right now and ask a shift manager, I'm almost confident he can tell you what are the top 10 risk significant systems.
Yeah, but more to the point, for a scenario, you can pick one of those components, and you can do an assessment of its importance. We have two or three different importance measures. We have risk assessment worth, and we have the Fussell-Vesely, and we have burn bomb importance. There's several ways of getting an insight into whether or not for that particular scenario, that particular component is or isn't important.
Correct. And what Bob is saying, for instance, in this case, if we're looking at the seal, potentially we can say what happens if the seal fell. Then you go through that accident scenario that are well developed under the probabilistic risk assessment. That tells you that RCP seal integrity could potentially lead into RCP seal-induced LOCA or other design-based accidents, and then they can go ahead and look at all those scenarios and sequences and tell you how significant they are and what's the contribution to total plant risk or CDF. So that's what you're talking about.
Exactly right. And, of course, if you find that a particular component, it fails from time to time, but it's not so important.
Yes.
Well, that's typically, you can review, others will review it, and it becomes a robust finding that enables the plant to prioritize what's important and what isn't important.
And then two more things I'd like to mention on this. One is, by the way, Diablo Canyon is one of the few plants in the country that recently installed the most advanced, up-to-date RCP seals, and we call them shutdown seals.
You bet.
And these are highly reliable, and that was one of the improvements we made to improve our fire protection risk. And there are not too many plants in the country that have done that. So that would even reduce their significance because they're a lot more tolerant. That's number one. Number two, going back to what you said, well, what if you get more of these things fail? Just for your information, as you may already know, anytime we get any NRC violations, findings, observations, regardless of how insignificant they are, we have a process that we enter all those into our corrective action program. And then we assign a team, and that team is going to evaluate this in more detail. And the purpose of that is just to do exactly what you said. What if you have other failures at the same time? So depending on the significance of these observations, violations, then we may have to do cause evaluations. Some of it we do full scope root cause evaluations to make sure that we take appropriate action and to prevent their occurrence in the future.
Well, but there's something more. The new seals have several advantages, among which is that the maintenance is easier and less prone to maintenance failures and the sort of things that we've learned from the industry experience.
Correct, yes.
But on the other hand, because there aren't so many of them around and they don't fail very much, we don't have much failure data. But you could do the analysis assuming that they were only as good as the previous seals.
That's correct.
For which we have a lot of data. And if it's still not important, then we know these are better. And that sort of sensitivity analysis is a common way of understanding a hierarchical importance of an item compared to other things.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. That would also provide
a very rational basis of
dismissing an issue, right? Because how else can we dismiss an issue?
You know? Well, it's very easy to dismiss some issues because you don't have to go through all this elaborate analysis to conclude that they're not important.
Right,
there are a lot of things like
right,
that.
Right. But to me, to dismiss an issue based on probability is certainly a systematic way of doing it, but that can be dangerous. Right? I would rather to see dismissal of an issue based on very fundamental observation.
That's right, yes.
For example, if you had a new seal that limits the gallon per minute, the GPM leakage rate, then that limitation is real, that you bracket your consequences.
Yeah, that's an absolute engineering.
Right. But that's to me, that's more reassuring to me than somebody say, well, the probability is XYZ.
And Dr. Lam, you're absolutely right. That's why there are two different school of thoughts in the earlier days. We used to call this risk-based approach. Now we call it risk-informed approach, and there's a reason. And the reason is exactly what your concern is. If you use risk-based, that means you only look at probabilities and PRA results.
Nothing else.
When you say risk-informed, that means PRA results and probabilities have one input to your overall decision-making. But right. Then you have to look at the engineering insights, maintenance aspects, operational concerns, along with your risk information. Then you make a risk-informed decision.
Right, right. So. And that, to me, would be a sensible way of moving
correct.
Forward.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank
did
you
I answer the question?
Yes, indeed. It's really an inquiry. I thought with your expertise, you can add value to our concern.
Besides, we're having fun.
So that was the summary of all the violations. And as I mentioned earlier, we also submitted to the NRC a licensee event report, and that was regarding an event that we had that, as you know, our containment, we have a large dry containment, and we have two systems called containment spray systems and containment fan cooler system. And their function mainly is to remove heat from the containment following a design basis accident. So during, as we were finishing up our activities during the last Unit 2 refueling outage, we were going from Mode 4 to Mode 5. And in Mode 5, you can isolate containment spray system, but not in Mode 4. So, but inadvertently, as we were transitioning for a very short period of time, as they were doing the maintenance work, they removed the power from containment spray pumps 1 and 2. So the whole system was not available or operable for maybe 10, 15 minutes. And there's a technical specifications requirements that says from mode 1 through 4, your containment spray system should be operable and available.
Right.
So, and then there's some NRC requirements that says if you meet these criteria, then you have to report that to the NRC under 50.73. So it's a very common practice and a known approach. And so we put together the report and issued it to the NRC at the end of January of this year.
That was the only LER
correct
in 2019.
Actually, this is the first LER in 2020 because we issued it in 2020, although the event occurred in 2019.
Yeah, but I don't think there was another LER in 2019.
That's correct.
As I recall.
You're absolutely right. Yes. Right. Any question on this? All right. So the next one is a quick summary again. I just want to reiterate that Diablo Canyon performance during this performance period was green based on the NRC performance indicators. And we have issued two reports during this period. One was the third quarter of 2019 integrated inspection report that was issued in October of 2019. And the other one was the fourth quarter of 2019 integrated inspection report, which was issued in January of 2020. And as you requested, a few months ago, you also wanted to look at some other status of other major licensing activities. So we mentioned last time that we had submitted to the NRC a license amendment request for our 90-minute ERO staff augmentation.
Right.
And we mentioned that this was approved, and I am happy to report back to you that it was fully implemented as of the end of January of this year. And then the other one that is currently with the NRC was with our intake reclassification. It was submitted to the NRC in early last year, and it should be approved soon, and our plan is to implement it in 2020. So that ends my presentation. However, Hector reminded me that last time we made an informal commitment to also talk a little bit about our overall cross-cutting aspect. So if you still have the time and interest, I can spend a few minutes talking about it. If not, I can do it next time.
Yes.
Yes, do it next time, or yes, do it now?
Go.
All right, so if that's the case, let me just be very brief, and if you would like to have a more detailed presentation, I can do it next time. So when we talk about cross-cutting aspects, as you saw through my presentation, on those all violations, some of them we said there's no cross-cutting aspects, some we said they're Hotel 7, Hotel 12. So NRC, as part of SDP process, significance determination process, has put together a concept that's called NRC cross-cutting issue. And what that means is they want to make sure if there's an issue that could impact more than one safety cornerstone, could potentially, you know, in the risk world, they call it common cause evaluation. Here is mainly impacting more than one safety cornerstone. Then they put together a guidance for the industry to follow. So the areas that cross-cutting issue covers, one is in the human performance, and one is in problem identification and resolution. So we call it in human performance and PINR. And in each area, then they have identified a number of traits, they call them. And traits could be things like leadership, safety, values and actions, continuing learning, questioning attitude. These are the traits under those two areas of cross-cutting issues. And then under each trait, then we have various aspects. And that's why we refer to as cross-cutting aspect, for instance, Hotel 12. So when we say aspects, for instance, under potential accountability, there's the aspect of teamwork. Under questioning attitude, we have aspects of challenging the unknowns, avoiding complacencies. So then there's a whole summary that then when a violation is assigned, the NRC would go back with their staff and try to figure out, do some evaluations as to this which aspect of cross-cutting issues should be assigned to a specific violation or finding. And sometimes they may find that none of them applies or they don't need to assign any. So that's the way they have put the guidance together, and it's a very well-used, widely utilized approach in the last 20 years by the licensees. And although sometimes it's some because they're so close, it's hard to exactly tell because it may not be exact science, either it's this one or that one, but usually we try to find the one that is more closely related to that finding or violations. So having said that, now I just want to tell you as of now where Diablo Canyon stands with respect to all these cross-cutting issues, areas, and aspects. So as we speak, as of the first quarter, we have a total of 6 cross-cutting aspects in human performance areas and 0 in problem identification and resolution. And in the human performance areas, and these are, they keep them for 4 quarters. They call them rolling average. So, for instance, right now we have the first quarter of 2020 plus the last 3 quarters of 2019. So when we go to the second quarter of 2020, then we drop the very last one. So right now, as we speak, we have a total of 6 in human performance. 1 is in resources. 1 is in documentation, and as you saw, that's how we got with some of those violations. And 1 is in procedure adherence and use. We also have 1 in challenging the unknowns, and 2 in avoiding complacency. So if you add them all up, you get about a total of 6. Yeah. Now, you know, you got to get a lot of them before you start worrying about them. In other words, you got to have like more than 5 or 6 in one given one just to even be able to really see if there is a theme or a trend. So we're way, way below the NRC threshold. But just to make sure that we are proactive, we have our own internal threshold that's way below the NRC so that as soon as we see we get 1 or 2 or a few, we go back and evaluate them, put the team together, talk to operations, maintenance, engineering to make sure if there's some learning opportunities, we take advantage of that and improve our processes and procedures. So that's where we are, and I hope that was a good summary and answered some of the questions that we had from last meeting.
It was, and that's what we were looking for the last time. I think I was the one that raised the question. You do, I believe, have a graphic that shows the matrix.
Yes.
And keeps account of that.
Yes.
Would it be possible to start including that regularly in your slides?
Yes.
I think it's generally publicly available.
Yeah, this is the screen.
That one, yes.
I will take that action with Hector and we'll include it in our presentations, and we use the latest one for that performance period.
That's great. Thank you.
All right, sure.
That we see those things, but showing them here with the public and so on is a very helpful
communication method.
Right. And if I may move on to another topic, the latest NRC inspection report had an unresolved item.
Mr. Wiseman had
a question about that yesterday, what that was about, and I was wondering if you could explain it to us.
So just to make sure, which one?
The unresolved item had to do with emergency sirens and batteries, I believe.
Yes. I think I can just summarize it from regulatory perspective, and I'm assuming that yesterday you got the more detailed background on
it. No, we did not. The question was raised, and we had not heard the details.
It was mentioned without enough. Go ahead. Whatever you can fill us in.
So I can just, since I haven't prepared myself for that, I'm going to refer to memory and tell you what that was. As part of, as you remember, last year, one of our inspections, latter part of last year, was on emergency planning. And actually, that emergency planning results were very positive. We had very, very few findings, or I believe we had one minor or one green, very low findings. But one of them, usually what happens is when NRC is looking into an issue, the inspectors, sometimes they don't have enough guidance in certain areas, or the issue is an evolving issue that the headquarters in Washington is trying to provide more guidance to the inspectors. So when the time is limited, so they don't have enough information to determine whether or not there is a concern, there's a finding, or there is a violation. So what they do, they use a process of calling it URI, unresolved issue. So this one was just like that, and I, based on my very limited memory, that was with respect to replacing some of the batteries of the emergency sirens, and apparently there's some requirements that you have to change them in some interval, and maybe that was not what NRC thought should have been done, and so they want to go back and see, and working with the county and the NRC headquarters to see how often the batteries need to be replaced. I think that's as much as I can remember. And if you would like, I can get some more info and get back to you.
Yes, the description of it, and I have it here in front of me, it's a failure to replace the early warning system batteries at periodically required by the alert and notification system design report.
So I was not wrong. So that was really...
Okay, well...
And again, this... Yes, please.
Along the way, we'll see something in next month's write-up about it, or we'll have a fact-finding, or we'll ask somebody.
We
don't want to just let this go by without learning something about it.
And because I don't remember the details, I want to make sure I am 100% factual. That's why I...
No, that's fair. We don't want to put you on the spot.
That's right, yes. I apologize.
No, you don't have to apologize.
Your memory is a lot better than mine.
So that's the end of my report. Okay. Any questions or comments?
Anything else? Yes, public.
Okay, let's entertain public comments.
Thank you.
On the speaker's outstanding presentation.
That was very helpful.
Thank you.
Hearing none.
Well, there being none, thank you again to our speaker, Mr. Bauman.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. Apologize. We test our emergency warning system and alerting system every 10 a.m. on Thursdays, so my phone was just notifying me that we're testing.
Yes, indeed.
You can set your clock by that, right? Which is further evidence that one is off. It's really irritating that one is wrong.
So, I have 10:04 on my watch, and it is a graded approach. It are individuals that have to respond within 60 minutes to an event get notified first, and then those that have 90 minutes per the recently approved license amendment will be notified subsequently.
Yeah.
So, thank you. And if we go now to our next presenter, we have Mr. Shane Guess. And Shane comes to us. He works in our business operations department, but he is a licensed senior reactor operator from the NRC. He's been a manager in our generation business planning team now for about a year and a half, and he's got 18 years experience at PG&E, particularly Diablo Canyon. He is an MBA from the University of Laverne and a Bachelor's of Science in Nuclear Engineering from Berkeley.
Oh, that's a good department.
I remember that.
And he's going to be speaking to us today. Tell us about the generation operating plan.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom. Good morning, members of the committee and members of the public.
Welcome.
I have the pleasure again to talk to you about the generation operating plan for 2020 through 2024. As you recall, I presented the nuclear generation operating plan last year to the committee as part of the public comment. So I'd like to describe, first of all, a little bit of change that we have this year with the operating plan. And you'll see on the first slide that we have here, it's our line of sight to generating excellence. So it's our line of sight to providing safe, reliable, and affordable energy to our customers. And that theme has not changed, as you'll see. Our focus areas, similarly, have not changed. They've suited us well in the past at Diablo Canyon. The one thing that has changed slightly for this year is the generation organization. The generation organization is now comprised of three separate organizations. That includes nuclear generation, power generation, which includes our hydro assets, fossil assets, and so forth, and then also a support organization called Generation Business and Technical Operations. So that all reports up to a senior vice president within PG&E. That's Jim Welsh. He's also our chief nuclear officer. So this operating plan really is the generation operating plan, but I'll be focusing more on the nuclear generation portion of it.
Okay. So the other generation assets under the company have a similar something in parallel to this that they worry about, which, of course, is not our concern here?
The other generation organizations are all tied up into this operating plan, but okay. There's specific portions of it and the key focus areas that have to do with their areas.
Their particular, maybe it's hydroelectric or something.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
So, for instance, dam safety is something that we'll see in sure. The generation operating plan, but that doesn't obviously pertain to nuclear, so I won't focus too much on that part of it. But each focus area that you see here, and I'll just name them for the benefit of the public, it's safety, people, reliability, affordability, risk compliance and ethics, and regulatory and external strategy. So each of those, we're aligning our generation organization to have committees to focus and leverage the skills of the other organizations in accomplishing our goals that are outlined in this operating plan.
Now, you know, Mr. Gass, this may not be a fair inquiry, but I do want your thoughts as well as Mr. Baldwin. You know, when I hear, this is not the first time I hear about the chief nuclear officer now had additional responsibility. You know, Mr. Welsh now is not only the chief nuclear officer on site, he also has the portfolio, all the power generation within the corporation, the PG&E. Now, that's a huge additional responsibility.
Right. Now, it's a lot smaller than when I was younger when they were burning a lot of fossil fuels.
That said, to me, you can look at it in two ways. You know, one is a corporation is really getting on the focus of safety, because you know the corporation can benefit from Mr. Welch's extensive experience in nuclear safety. But the other side of the coin is now your chief nuclear officer had other things to attend to. Right? One can speculate, is that a dilution of his attention? Right? I mean, I don't know how one should address that. I have yet to have the chance to talk to Mr. Welsh because the last time when I was on site, he was not here, so I had a chat with Ms. Paula Guffin, who is the site vice president, okay, and we talk about that issue as well. You know, I don't know what you know the senior manager like you and Mr. Ballman look at it. Do you see your access to the chief nuclear officer being reduced by necessity because you are the
I could add a little bit for that, Dr. Lamb. In our previous role prior to Jim Welsh, our previous senior officer was Mr. Ed Halpin. He was also our chief nuclear officer, and he also had the same responsibilities that Jim has now, which included power generation. So I wouldn't say you actually hit it in the first point that you mentioned. The rest of the company is trying to leverage Jim's expertise in nuclear and all our processes that we have in order to improve the rest of the company. And that being said, Jim also has leaders that are responsible now for the power generation that report to him. So he does have people that report to him. For example, in power generation, it was just announced that Mr. Jan Nimick will be taking on power generation as the vice president.
And I'll add to that, too. Thanks, Hector. Right now, Jim Walsh is presently at the plant site giving a listening and learning session presentation to anyone that's interested in hearing. So there's no absence of Jim Walsh on site. We see him visibly all the time. He's very engaged with his workforce. And he's also, as you said, Dr. Lamb, this does benefit the entire generation organization. We see, as Hector mentioned, Jan Nimick, one of our senior directors previously at the site, is now the vice president over power generation. So there are benefits, and I don't foresee any issues with him being diluted with his attention towards Diablo. He does have Diablo Canyon Power Plant, the nuclear facility, and several other facilities to oversee, but he has his organization comprised of Paula Gerfen, Jan Nimick, and now the interim leader, Maureen Zawalik, is leading the generation business and technical operations. So there is plenty of oversight. But it is something to consider.
Great, that's a good feedback.
Well, I was gonna argue that for certain issues there's an advantage to the breadth. Okay,
which is
because issues that arise there we can learn from, just as they can learn from issues that arise here.
Absolutely, we're seeing some of that already. We have a lot more collaboration, I'd say, with power generation, a lot more influence. And we get insights. These committees that I alluded to earlier that have been formed, we have committees for all of the focus areas now, and we're seeing a lot more cooperation between power generation and nuclear generation. And it's a win-win situation, I would say.
I mean, I had in mind, for example, that the rest of the generating assets have to interface with the transmission part of the company, and there could be some lessons learned about how that works in reliability and safety.
I would agree. I don't have insight into that specifically, but I would agree with you.
I mean, that's a possibility in which from time to time there might be something that arises that would be we're glad somebody like Welsh was there to translate it directly.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll move into looking back at 2019. Part of my presentation will just briefly focus on some of the results we achieved with our 2019 operating plan. And also I'll highlight later on what we're looking forward to in 2020 and beyond. So looking at 2019, as you see on the screen, 2019 was a very busy year for nuclear generation. We had the organizational change that I alluded to earlier. We completed two refueling outages. So dual outage years are very intense for us. We devote a lot of resources and time to planning and executing those outages. But we had the successful outage 2R21 that ended in December of this past year. And that the main thing in that one, the main project that we did was upgraded the generator stator. So that contributes to unit reliability through the end of the operating license. And that was a very major project, a multi-million-dollar project. So that completed successfully in mid-December. We had peer evaluations last year from industry peers, rated excellent. We had reaccreditation of our training programs, all training programs. And we had the, as Mr. Hamzy described, we had the 90-minute license amendment request approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which also contributes to better safety. We have 90 minutes to respond to any emergency. We have better coping capabilities in the control room during that time, and that also expands the people that are available for the emergency response organization to those that are a little bit farther away. So previously, we had to respond within an hour. Now now we have more flexibility going forward, and that will help us as some of the staffing starts to drop over the next few years and so forth. We also did talk about the NRC performance previously, and we're still in column one, which is licensee response, the highest NRC performance category. So we do keep the insight into the violations and act on them, put them in our corrective action program, and learn from them. Final one I have on here is the NRC triennial force-on-force security inspection. So that was also successful. No major violations from that. And if you look at that screen, you can see it was a very busy year for us, and I think we're all going to take a sigh of relief, but still maintain focus on this year because there's a little less to do, but still it's going to be interesting because this, as I talked to you last time, will be the end of the Tier 1 retention coming in August. So we'll see probably a downsizing a little bit of people that are leaving due to attrition and retirement and so forth. So I'll get a little bit more on that later. Some of the measurable results from the 2019 operating plan. We have the first line there, DCPP, Reliability and Safety Indicator. It's really a composite of performance that we can quantify based on dose results, capacity factor, safety, chemistry results. So I won't get into the inner workings of that number, but we did actually exceed our goal for the end of the year. We, since the last time I spoke, we had the 2R21 outage. So radiation exposure is another key metric that we focus on. And that one we did very well with regard to the accumulated dose that our workers received during that outage. The one thing that we need to work, well, it's more than one thing, really. One area that we need to work on continually is safety. Preventable motor vehicle incidents, some of the other injuries, OSHA reportable injuries, injuries that result in days away or lost time. Those we didn't meet the mark, but we're doing a lot to make sure that we are successful in that area coming forward. That's number one importance, public safety, worker safety, nuclear safety. So that's why it's also a key element of the operating plan. Some of the insights we have for that area are we have this philosophy that has been rolled out that all injuries are preventable, that leadership is responsible for preventing injuries, that we build safety into all of our work plans, and that we look out for each other. So that's the key thing that all leaders need to keep in mind, all workers need to keep in mind going forward. Some of the other ones, I think you've already been, this has already been explained as far as regulatory findings and NRC reactor oversight process, so we all are in the highest category there. All right, any questions on that before I move forward? All right, so I'll move into the 2020 generation operating plan, key elements of that in the separate categories that I mentioned previously. First thing I want to mention is our leadership model. So I mentioned our mantra is safe, reliable, affordable operation through 2025. We're doing that through a leadership model that we've found very successful over the past couple of years, engage, enable, sustain. So we want to make sure that our workers, our employees are engaged, feel strong intrinsic motivation, we enable them to achieve results, and then we sustain high performance. And the sustained part of that is that we react quickly and promptly to any sign of decline, however minor it may be. The other part of that is our speak up, listen up, follow up expectation, that if we do have a concern raised by any person, that we hear that out, we act upon it, and we follow up. So that's one way to achieve this. That's one element of our leadership model as well. So as I promised, 2020 at a glance, these are the key things that I want to focus on as far as this year. So we have one refueling outage to prepare for. We start that process very early, at least a year ahead of time in planning, preparing, before we finally execute. But that refueling outage is going to be in October of this year. And all subsequent outages until we shut the plant down will be based on a very standard model. And we're shooting for 33-day durations. And project implementation will be going down as far as how many projects we'll be implementing. But we have one refueling outage on Unit 1. We have the retention period, which is ending. That, as you recall, that's a four-year period over which we set up the retention program as part of California state law to keep people here, the critical needs, proficient workers here, while we get into the later years of Diablo Canyon operation. So that ends on August 31st. So during that time, probably a little bit before, a little bit after, and possibly after the first of the year, we do expect to see our staffing go down somewhat. But we're taking efforts and planning to make sure that that doesn't hit us in any particular area. And if we do see signs based on intelligence that we might have challenges in a certain area, we are acting to make sure that we are proactive rather than reactive. And following that, Tier 2 begins the next day, September 1st. So that Tier 2 retention period is the three-year period that goes from 2020 to 2023. And then finally after that, we'll face the last 2 years of Diablo Canyon operation. So we do have also a Nuclear Regulatory Commission emergency planning exercise. So that'll be a full-scope drill observed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And actually, it's my team that's being evaluated. So we'll have all of our emergency facilities activated, the emergency operations facility off-site, the technical support center on-site, Joint Information Center as well. So that's going to be in August of this year. One thing I thought it was pertinent pointing out, leader in the field engagement. This is one of our strategies that was launched last year, but it's been highly successful both in nuclear generation and power generation. We expect that supervisors, managers, directors get out into the field and find out what obstacles are preventing their workers from achieving success or what's frustrating them, what's possibly in the way of injuring them, and taking action. So it's part of our speak up, listen up, follow up as well. So we have discussions at the senior leadership team meeting on a daily basis for what have leaders seen in the field? What are we doing to make workers' lives better? What are we doing to make their work easier, more efficient? And then finally, for 2020, we have a mid-cycle self-assessment. So that's our progress in resolving some issues that have been identified by external agencies and working to improve performance towards excellence. So the mid-cycle self-assessment is a two-week process where we have peers come in and tell us where we can get better, what efforts we still need to achieve in some areas, and so forth. That's a very big planned out process. So that'll be in October of this year.
Let me ask a question about 2020.
Yes.
And Hossein may have the answer to this. Does NRC plan a major inspection during 2020?
The NRC has several inspections that they do. They have their regular quarterly inspections, but they also have special inspections. I know this year there's cybersecurity. They have their 5059 inspection. They have their problem identification and resolution inspection coming up. I don't have the key dates for those, but there are several inspections that they do periodically.
So you got a busy year coming up.
Yes, indeed. So the problem identification and resolution inspection is a big effort, too. So that's one of the bigger ones.
Thank you.
Yeah, just want to observe. The major evaluated exercises in the third week in August, and as I said, you're Alpha?
I'm Alpha,
so
yes,
so
indeed.
It's going to be the Alpha team this year.
Yes, okay, it is.
As you mentioned. We have a fact-finding right then. Those dates are chosen in part so that we can observe that, among other things that we'll do when we're here.
Oh, excellent.
Okay.
I'll be looking for you then.
I believe it's August 19, right?
That's the date that I have in mind,
right,
too.
Right. That's what we, I mean, good. We agree.
I won't be scheduling vacation during that time.
Before
I will be.
One additional also clarification, and Shane did a great job explaining what our 2020 plans are coming up. Just a clarification for our refueling outage that happens here in October, 1R22. Our business plan for that is 40 days on that outage.
Yeah.
Thanks for the correction, Hector.
This is actually a little bit of a tangential question, but it relates to not scheduling vacation. We've got this coronavirus in China now, and we don't know what's going to happen with it, right? And so I believe the plant has procedures to deal with situations where staffing and other things are challenged because of public health problems and other things. And given that we might see over this coming year significant stress placed on global public health systems and limitations on people's ability to travel and send stuff around, I think actually it's not to discuss it in any detail here, but it may be worthwhile for us to go and take a look at that set of questions associated with the plant's capabilities to cope with a variety of different things, but in this case, I think it's worthwhile for us to check and see if we do see coronavirus emerge as a global pandemic, how that might impact the plant.
Thanks, Dr. Peterson. That's a good insight. I know we had talked several years ago about SARS, H1N1, and I know there was a response to that, but I can't remember. I couldn't give you the details on it, but it is worthy of looking into.
Let's go ahead and refresh on that topic. It's timely right now because it may not emerge as a problem, but the experience from SARS, I think, would be quite relevant. And moreover, I'm sure that this is something that the industry level has been thought through as well.
And, of course, when the key point is that when you're in a public health emergency, the most important thing you can do is maintain stable access to basic services, particularly electricity, right? And so because without electricity, we can't get our communication systems to work. Our transportation system will rapidly break down. And so it's very important that we have that capability to keep running even when we're being challenged this way, because it supports all the other efforts that you're taking with respect to public health.
Absolutely. Diablo Canyon is a valuable asset. I mean, 2,400 roughly megawatts. Understand that that's a key importance to people that can't have something else taken away from them during that time.
One of the interesting things we think about is that one of the things is if you start to lose electrical power, one of the problems is that all of your fossil infrastructure is challenged, because ultimately the supply of fuel to the electricity system for all the fossil, and we can't, I mean, every evening in California, we're ramping up about 10 to 14 gigawatts of natural gas capacity, most of it out of state, in order to respond to the drop. And if you can't deliver the fossil fuel, then you're going to be really, really challenged. And so it's sort of a positive feedback kind of problem. And we don't have any plans to deploy enough storage to be able to cope with the grid scale problem of things like, you know, the evening demand. And so this overall question of how do we maintain reliable and stable access to electricity in these kinds of scenarios is something it's timely for us to look at, I think.
Indeed. Thank you for the concern.
So we can follow up with you in one of your upcoming fact-finding visits. Have you lined up with some of our leaders that can speak to our pandemic preps.
Yeah,
just
wondering. My memory is not crystal clear, but I remember that the SARS threat came about six, 8 years ago.
Okay.
And 10. I wasn't sure, but anyway, that the whole nuclear industry mobilized to have plans that each plant took cognizance of and was ready to do something with, and then it never came our way in an important way. Mm-hmm. So it didn't happen. But there was a whole incipient plan, and I'll bet anybody here a dollar that, of course, that sort of thing will be activated if we need to. It was there already, mm-hmm. although not necessary, for which we're thankful. So yeah. I don't think there's any chance that that's going to come this way without the industry being prepared generally and each station being prepared generally.
Right. It's definitely a good time to refresh on that. I know it's relatively new news, but it's the right time now to act upon it. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, if there is something we can refresh, this one's slightly different as I understand it, maybe more virulent.
My memory was it was the senior leadership, so probably somebody like Jim Becker or somebody that said, yeah, yeah, it's there if we need it, and then nothing happened.
Right.
Thank God.
And right. That's exactly the right approach, right?
Right.
We really should have a plan. You know, based on the World Health Organization's latest thing, you know, you're dealing with a brand new virus that has a postulate or not, which is how many people one ill individual will be able to infect, and or not being about 3 to 4, in contrast to SARS virus, it or not about 1.8 to about 2, and a flu virus has an R naught maybe 1.1, 1.3. So now you had a virus then can be rapidly transmitted. Now the fatality ratio, according to the WHO, it's about 2%. Right? But this is a threat that needs to be taken seriously. A plan being developed now would be timely, right? The SARS fatality ratio is about 10%, and the virus transmitted by camel has a fatality about 30%, right? But it does not have the same transmission vectors here,
right?
So the plan, you know, we really need to base on the WHO latest some information, then if it involves a symptomatic transmission, means before the patient is symptomatic, it can be infectious, then you really need a good plan.
Yeah, absolutely. A better plan this time. If I understand correctly, it's up to 2 weeks before you can be symptomatic, so that presents challenges. So
you bet the incubation period now it's like 2 weeks, right? But before any symptom shows up, the patient can infect others with an R naught of 3, so the growth would be exponential.
Correct. The interesting point, though, also is that this that the coronavirus, the fatality fraction is about 2%. So that probably enters into one strategy. The main thing you want to do is to make sure that you don't have people falling ill and therefore not being available for a substantial period of time until they've recovered. It's not that they're unlikely to recover because it's a relatively small. I mean, it's a high enough fraction that at the national scale, this is in China, this is a real, real serious problem. This is probably not to go into any more detail right now, but definitively, let's make sure that we take this up in right. a future fact finding.
Right. Right.
Continue.
Great.
Continue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'll move into our key elements of the operating plan now. I'll cover each one individually, give a few words about what we're doing in each category. Safety, as I said, put safety first. That's the most important one to begin with. This one, our plans, goals include getting to first quartile safety performance over the next year, 1 to 2 years. But through that, we're going to leverage the leader in the field engagement. That's a key element there. It's making sure that we respond to everything that people bring up. And make sure that we remove the safety hazard if there is one, rather than try to control it or use procedural guidance to mitigate it. Safety, as I mentioned, OSHA recordables, vehicle incidents, and things that keep us away from work for any reason.
Sure.
And that does include nuclear safety in outage performance, in training, and all of our site-wide processes. The other one that I have here on the slide is people. One example I'd like to include here is our Generation People Committee. That's something that I'm involved with. Some subsequent speakers will be involved with. But that integrates all of our generation resources, human resources. And as Dr. Lamb mentioned and others, this is where we can leverage the entire generation organization to achieve results. We can rotate people from nuclear generation to other lines of business to help them. For instance, one good example here is our quality verification organization. Power generation in the past hadn't had such an organization, with audits and assessments and so forth. We're going to leverage our QV team at Diablo Canyon to help them out with some of the issues that they may be facing in audits and assessments and leverage their skill in pointing out where can we improve. So that's one example of how we plan to leverage people throughout across the generation organization. We also will be focusing on this year with regard to people on pathways to your future. As you know, we have 5 years of operation roughly left for Diablo Canyon, and this is in the stage where we want to look at finding our pathways for all of our employees. I discussed this in greater detail earlier at a last public session. But after I find the pathway, we'll be planning for it, executing it, and so forth. But right now it's in the planning session. So that includes things such as what do people want to see themselves doing? How do you best plan for that? Do you need a college degree? How can we help you with that? PG&E has a lot of resources that can help out with some of the workers in that regard. Reliability is next. This really focuses on some of the maintenance outage windows we perform, our outage performance, and making sure that we resolve some of our equipment issues that have been raised as the top 10 issues that we want to correct. So in that, we'll be forming a committee. Already have actually formed a committee across generation. We will leverage our nuclear committees, such as our plant health committee, plant health prioritization committee, to make sure that we have addressed the top 10 issues and continually refresh that list so that we have continued reliable performance at Diablo Canyon. So that'll be sustaining that continued high reliability. Affordability is also on this slide. The reason I put it with reliability, too, is that we want to make work more efficient, and we want to make sure that we reduce costs to our customers. However, that bottom sentence there will always continue to put safety ahead of affordability. So if there's any competition whatsoever, we always take the road of we make sure that the work is safe, processes are safe, before we try to cut cost. So that's a key insight that nuclear has, and we continue to celebrate. The last two, risk, compliance, and ethics, and regulatory and external strategy. So one element of the risk, compliance, and ethics category that I'd like to describe is making sure that we use, as you mentioned earlier, leveraging that quantitative risk analysis to inform decisions. So, for instance, power generation can benefit from this. We have a really detailed, very knowledgeable probabilistic risk assessment team at Diablo Canyon that models some of that decision-making, and we want to extend that into power generation as well. Continually refine our models as we get new data. For example, we talked about the reactor coolant pump shutdown seals earlier. That's one great example. We'll continue to get operating experience that will benefit both us and the industry in that respect. Also, it could be utilized for power generation purposes and elements such as dam safety. As far as regulatory and external strategy, there's a lot of things that are balls up in the air right now, juggling. One includes the decommissioning of Diablo Canyon. That's a multi-year process for preparation and execution. Another one is divestiture of hydro assets. So these things, we want to make sure that we are in full compliance with laws, regulations, and that's going to be our major focus there. And that's why it's on the forefront as one of the key focus areas. So with that, I'll just come back to the overall slide here. So the key focus areas, the six focus areas that have served us well in the past, I've highlighted as the things that will continue to sustain us in the future and extending that to power generation. But the overall message is we want to provide safe, reliable, affordable power to our customers. And this operating plan and some of the detail within it is the roadmap for us to get there. So with that, I'd like to open it up to any questions you may have on elements of the operating plan or some of the performance or results for this year or last year.
Committee member comments?
Question.
No, I guess we've been.
If I'm an individual contributor or even a supervisor, I've got a performance plan. Can I link that to this? What you just showed there, is there a direct link line of sight to that?
Absolutely, there is. What happens for the operating plan? The operating plan's put out with all of the high-level goals and the metrics that we use to achieve those goals that we use as a measure. And then from there, the goals are cascaded down from the chief nuclear officer down to the individual contributor for how does your work relate to achieving this goal. So each one of the goals in people's performance plans, they are categorized by these focus areas. So, for instance, we're in that process right now, actually, for 2020. So I could foresee a goal of mine would be for instance, in safety, making sure that I get out into the field as a manager every so often, making sure that I'm addressing any safety concern that comes up. And that could be seen in any corrective action document. That could be seen in any initiative that I'm running. So there is a direct tie from everyone's performance plan all the way up to the top.
And I assume you have an incentive plan for at least your non-represented employees. Is that also tied to these particular focus areas?
Both represented and non-represented. The represented employees have their job functions, and they're not managed they're not managed the same as non-represented employees, obviously. But their goals are given to them. They're fed back to them periodically as well, and they're all tied together.
Okay. Thank you.
Comments from the committee's bench?
No, it's good.
Let's entertain public comments on the speaker's presentation.
That was helpful.
Thank you very much.
There being no public comments, thank you to our speaker for an excellent presentation. It is time for a break, so let us reconvene in 15 minutes.
So that's a 5-2.
support. You're ready, right? You're ready. Okay.
There's lots. I mean, you go right over.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, after a brief break, let us reconvene our meeting on the second day of the 95th public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Before we go to the next item on our agenda, Mr. Tom Borman, the Director of Business Planning, would have some remarks to make. Mr. Borman.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. So I just wanted to follow up on a number of questions that had come up in the last day. First off, you had been asking whether we could arrange for the simulator to be available for a plant tour on July 1st. I did confirm. We have 10:30 to 11 o'clock set aside for a public tour on July 1st.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
We had gone through our 2R21 refueling outage, and one of those slides indicated we had 904 workers come to our station from other places that to just help us on that refueling outage.
Not all at the same time, of course.
Not all at the same time.
But over the outage, yeah.
So looking south to Lompoc and north to San Miguel, we had 33% of that 904 coming from within this range. So two-thirds of them were from out of area. Out of our total outage workers, we had 11.3% female.
Uh-huh. What was the number?
11.3%. Okay. One
now,
out of ten.
Now, the two-thirds coming from out of the area are presumably specialists with particular expertise, contractors or something like that mostly, whose particular, I mean, they know just how to do a certain technical task that wouldn't be available locally, generally. That's what I'm thinking.
Typically, we also have contractors, though, such as Westinghouse, that come and their crew typically does refueling outage type of work. And sometimes they have basic laborers as well because we have them turnkey their scope of work.
So they bring experts and then they hire locally some mix. Yeah.
They would, yes. Yeah. We asked about what the funding source was after we shut down, stop power operations, for our emergency sirens and the maintenance and testing of those. It is specifically from our nuclear decommissioning trust fund.
Oh, it's part of that.
It is absolutely part of that. So as we suspected, but I did confirm that.
And that money is required by the NRC.
Correct. Yes, I mean, we have license commitments to still make.
Yeah.
We do have to maintain an emergency plan, and so I did confirm that the funding has explicitly been included as part of our nuclear decommissioning cost triennial proceeding rate case.
Now, Mr. Bowman, is the funding level meets the expectations of the county? Or is it a funding level within the decommissioning trust fund, however they may wish to allocate it consistent with the regulation? So there may or may not be a mismatch there, right? The county is expecting a certain amount. The decommissioning trust fund may allocate a different amount. I'm just speculating.
So the PG&E telecommunications department maintains all of the sirens. Okay, we do all the maintenance on it. If we do periodic testing, we do inspections, and we buy replacement batteries, we buy replacement siren heads. We've got detailed procedures and training for all the sirens in the area. Uh-huh. So we've got TCOM folks with bucket trucks that go out to do that maintenance, the inspections. We deal with the vendors on that equipment. It's not the county.
Right. Okay. Right. So the trustee of the decommissioning fund would just follow the regulation and approve the funding, the budgetary approval. Okay. Yes. That makes sense, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sure. And just a bit of clarification, there was a couple times this come up, the unresolved issue of the from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's inspection report on the 3-year versus 5-year battery replacement on the sirens. The reason that's an unresolved issue is because they came on site, did their inspection, and there is a process in place for any kind of changes to the maintenance, and that involves FEMA. And so the NRC had needed some documentation to resolve their questions. That was not documentation that PG&E had. We needed to get that from FEMA. And so that is in process. They're following up. FEMA's providing that information to the NRC. So we will expect to see that those questions documented in an upcoming NRC inspection report, as well as the resolution of that. Okay?
That's sort of an odd thing.
What's that?
I just think it's odd.
It is odd. We don't normally see that. And that's all I had.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Now, let's go to the next item on our agenda, which will be the committee's technical consultant's report to the committee on a fact-finding meeting just happened a month ago. Mr. Furman, Waddell.
Rick said he'd take me over during lunch.
Yeah.
No, Rick said, yeah. I'm embarrassed. I've never lost a game.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be using the slide on the screen, of course, PowerPoint, of the items that we looked at. Dr. Lambert, you're in my January 29th and 30th fact-finding report. And I'll go through each of these items with separate slides. The first thing we did was to attend a plant health committee. We do this periodically, not every fact-finding, but maybe every second or third one we like to do the plant health committee. And the first bullet there shows some of the things that they're responsible for. In a nutshell, basically the plant health committee is where management and senior management monitors and takes action on the health of the various systems, components, and programs. And they do it on a regular basis. They have a procedure for that, and we looked at the procedure, the updated procedure, and it's quite adequate.
Now, if I may interrupt for the benefit of the audience, this fact-finding meeting happened only 2 weeks ago, and Mr. Waddell was willing and able to expedite the development of this report in a 2 weeks period.
And then less because he had to send it out for me to review and you.
That's right.
Right, right, right. So, you know, he now set the standard of speedy delivery of the fact-finding report.
Gave me something to do on the plane on the way back. The second bullet, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it. The second bullet talks about two important things that came up at the meeting, two of the major subjects. The first was the 4 kV breaker reliability, and the Plant Health Committee had a presentation by the breaker engineer, component engineer, who gave a very good presentation on some of the problems that some of the breakers have had, not all of them, the corrective action for that, and an action plan to assure that the breakers are reliable and can be repaired by the suppliers if they need to be. And the breakers that are in stock in the warehouse, and there are plenty of them for replacement, that they are ready to be replaced at a moment's notice. So they set up an augmented preventive maintenance program to be sure those breakers are set and ready to go into the plant if they need to be used to replace a faulty breaker. So that was a good story there, and the Plant Health Committee approved that. The second item was brought in was a change to a preventive maintenance for the insulators for a 500 kV tower, the ones that leads out of the plant. The insulators, you may recall in the past there were some flashes. Let me back up a little bit. The insulators are the ceramic or glass things that are used to hang the wires from the towers. And their job, obviously, is to insulate the wiring from the metal towers. In the environment at Diablo, salt spray, rain, wind, dust, the insulators can become contaminated. with those components. And if they are left, they can cause non-insulation or shorts, and it results in flashes or shorts. So the station has a program to wash these insulators periodically to eliminate the contaminants. They're changing the frequency of these. They're actually extending it from, I believe it's annually, to every second or every unit two refueling outage, which is about 18 to 20 months. And they're doing that, and the justification for that is they put new insulators in with a new ceramic material, which don't require washes as frequently as before. So good story there, and the Plant Health Committee approved that request. As far as the meeting, it was run very crisply, very effective, and there was good participation by all of the attendees. Good discussion. It's worth our time to go to these meetings, I think. Our next item was we looked at the maintenance department. We do this periodically at various departments, engineering, maintenance, ops. And we typically talk to the maintenance personnel about what's going on, an update. We look at the performance indicators. And these items I have 1 through 14, I'm not going to read all those, but you can see these are the key performance indicators that the maintenance department uses to measure themselves. And except for number 11, control room workarounds and board notifications, these are all green. Number 11 was yellow, but I think it has already turned green back in before the end of January. It was to have done that. I hadn't checked it, but I'm pretty sure it probably did. So good performance by the maintenance department. We inquired about staffing, and the maintenance department has a little over 300 people, 310, I believe the exact number was.
And coming down.
And right, then coming down. Thank you, Bob, for that lead-in. Come August, there will be the people are leaving because of the first retention period being over. They don't know exactly how many. They figure about 60 or so. So, and as far as how that leaves them, and say starting in September, they'll replace certain key positions that are needed to be replaced. Others they won't, because of work cutbacks and other things that are planned. For example, the preventive maintenance optimization has reduced the preventive maintenance load. And if they need temporary help, they'll hire contractors to come in to get the work done. So the work will get done, and there'll be a little more streamlined maintenance organization. We then looked at troubleshooting. I mean, this is a maintenance procedure. And troubleshooting, as you can see by that first bullet, is a formal process that establishes a systematic approach to looking at problems, what's failed, and that sort of thing. The procedure, we looked at this, I guess, a year and a half ago or 2 years ago. Procedure hadn't changed much. It was adequate then. It's adequate now. It's a nice procedure. It's pretty clear. It gives responsibilities. It tells how to go through troubleshooting and when to use troubleshooting. There are two levels of troubleshooting. Level A, as you can see, it affects safety-related systems or plant reliability. B are the other ones that aren't quite that significant. We looked at three troubleshooting packages. I showed them here, one level A and two level Bs. The level A, Cardox, is a fire protection, fire mitigation system in the emergency diesel generator rooms. And they had performed a test on the Cardox system on one of the emergency diesel generators, and they found the reset button was not working. Well, that didn't sound too serious, but the fact that it wasn't working meant that that particular Cardox system was inoperable. Mm-hmm. And they have a certain time period to get that back in service. They performed troubleshooting, found a faulty relay, replaced it, and the system checked out fine. The second one, level B, the first level B, or the second bullet, was a rectal coolant pump motor vibration indication. All the rectal coolant pumps have vibration monitors on them, as we heard yesterday. And they had gotten some funny signals on pump 1-3. And as they performed troubleshooting on it, they found other signals that came off the pump. For example, the shaft movement showed no vibration, so they didn't think they had any vibration problems, and they didn't. They had a faulty vibration monitor. Again, it was, I believe it was a relay or a loose lead, perhaps, found during troubleshooting. They repaired that, and everything was fine after that. A classic troubleshooting situation. Finally, that third one, the second level B, was a pressurizer heater group. A control room light went out, and again, like kind of like that reset not working, you wouldn't think a light going out would be bad, but it interfered with the operation of the heater. They performed a troubleshooting package on that, and I believe that turned out to be a relay as well, which they replaced, and the system was tested back to normal. So our conclusion was the procedure is good, and the implementation as per at least these three troubleshooting packages was satisfactory. Still in maintenance, so we looked at, this is a review of some work going on. We'd like to do this periodically. We talked about this a little bit yesterday, and we wanted to look at some work packages. The planning group, if there's a job to be done, in this case, it was some jobs on the lube oil centrifuges, and your work package for these, which includes drawings, procedures, other things that are important to getting the job done so the mechanics in the field can take the package out, know what materials, equipment they need, and how to proceed through the process. So we looked at three work packages for the Unit 2 lube oil centrifuges. The centrifuges, there's one for each unit. They're down in the lower level of the turbine building on the 85-foot level. They are there to purify the lube oil through the centrifuge process. And we looked at these three packages. The first was to sample and then change the gearbox oil between the motor and the centrifuge itself. The second was to clean and inspect the centrifuge as they were putting it back together. And then the third was to replace the mechanical seal on the centrifuge. And we looked at all three work packages in the office, went out into the station, and watched the mechanics perform two. They were actually replacing the seal and putting the centrifuge back together by the time we got out there. So we spent an hour or so looking at overseeing that, talking to the mechanics, watching how they did their procedures. Which requires that they use, on the procedure steps, use a circle and slash, which means they circle the step they're working on. When they finish, they put a slash through it so they know where they are and what they've done. They were doing that. They had their protective, personal protective gear on. They were using the right tools. They had the foreign material exclusion barrier set up. They were doing everything right, in other words. And we found that the work they did was performed properly, professionally. And the plant was, as usual, orderly and clean. Here's some photos on the left. The centrifuge is that yellow thing on the left, back in the back, brown thing. And that's me on the left talking to the mechanics, going over there, looking at their work packages. And then on the right, just observing the work going on from a different angle. You can see the mechanic's hard hat over on the left. A good operation. This is something we saw yesterday, the video. We looked at the video. We screened it to be sure it was acceptable for use here in the public meeting, and it worked out just fine. Dr. Lamb then met with Paula Gerfen, the site vice president. Peter, you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, a couple of topics that we had, we, means I and Ms. Gerfen, talk about extensively. One is the new organization responsibilities. As I indicated earlier, you know, the chief nuclear officer now had a much larger portfolio than he had before, and that tend to benefit the other parts of the corporation because his nuclear safety expertise is would be very beneficial to other parts. The second item is about affordability. As the previous speaker talked about, the plant staff always put safety first and affordability second. Now, that said, you know, there is always a concern, where is the line? You know, is people being overzealous in the cost-cutting effort, and what probable or potential impact it may be to safety. Now, that's a difficult subject. You know, at the policy level, safety first, saving money is second priority, certainly makes sense. at the practical level, when you eliminate programs or planned activity, one can always speculate there may be a potential for adverse impact. But one can always look at it differently. If the program can be cut, it's either you expect people who would do more with less, or the program was not necessarily efficient in the first place. So, you know, there are many really angles to this discussion.
That's, I think, important. And the ability for us to understand whether or not we should have concern, I think, that's one of the reasons why we've been very interested in the overall budgets being provided to the plant and whether those are being cut, because there's two ways that you can employ efficiency. If you're working within a constant budget, which appears to be the case, then efficiency comes from stopping doing things that add lower value and initiating new things that add greater value. I would not be as concerned. If we see what we want to be looking for, I think, is cases where budgets are being reduced and the total funding for the plant is going down. There's a logical basis for us to expect that to happen as we're approaching the cessation of operations, because there are certain types of activities that you need to do at steady state, such as major equipment maintenance and replacement, that become unnecessary because the preventive maintenance and other things extends, you know, past the date of closure. So this is an important question for us. This is the reason we've also been worried about bankruptcy. But what we've been told is that the total budgets for the plant have been staying stable. So in that case, I think that's some evidence that we probably don't have to have a large concern, but need to watch this closely.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Then we met with the NRC, like we do pretty much every fact-finding meeting, compare notes, what they're looking at, and they like to hear what we're looking at and finding. Here we talked a little bit about NRC's reducing the inspection hours for the independent spent fuel storage facilities. And this really isn't just blankly reducing hours. It's just working smarter and focusing on what's more important, like Per was just saying, and unfocusing on what's less important.
Now, Dr. Butness, as a matter of fact, asked the team to make this inquiry. I believe there were some communication people talk between Dr. Butness and us and Dr. Peterson about the...
Well,
he was saw in the newspaper, Dr. Butness?
No, I saw an article in the trade press in which this reduction had been agreed to for a different plant back east. And in the article, they said that the NRC's policy was going towards this as a general policy rather than the specific case that I saw. And so I inquired. I just asked the question.
Right, and the answer is yes.
The question I asked was, there's a fact-finding coming up. See what you can learn.
Right, so when we were on site, you know, we had a discussion there.
And the idea was, ask the resident inspector.
Right, and the answer to your inquiry is yes. There is a generic push from the agency to do more with less, with the emphasis on risk-informed regulations. So they've been pushing that on all of the programmatic activities. So this is not the isolated case.
That's correct. That's what we found out of this fact-finding as well.
Right.
There's a general push to reduce that based on risk-informed decision-making.
Well, you know, we all know the impetus is ever since the agency had adopted users' fee, you know, there is a great deal of pressure from the payer to the payee to make sure the money is well spent.
Well, I'm not disputing at all that efficiency is important, but the devil's in the details, and we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I was asking was, okay, at Diablo Canyon, if there was to be a different inspection regime in the future, what was being eliminated or maybe done less frequently, and what was its rationale? It's a simple question, and it's a fair question.
Now, it relates to the regional inspection activity.
Oh, no, I understand. These are people coming from Region 4.
Right.
And so they're inspecting numerous plants besides this plant. And, of course, they coordinate carefully with the resident inspectors where they'll come and do something, and then they'll ask the resident inspectors to do periodic follow-ups and that sort of thing. So it was a simple question about if it is so, then our committee ought to try to understand the rationale and see whether we think the rationale holds water. Fair enough.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it does, but maybe it doesn't. Huh?
We'll wait and see, right? We'll wait and see.
Well, even though they're reducing across the board, if they find something, they're going to jump on it and look at it. You know, they're not going to let this.
No, I understand that too, but let's suppose, I'm going to make something up. I'm making something up. Let's suppose there's a certain inspection frequency, suppose annually, that they put in place 25 years ago when the first of these installations was being installed at different stations. And in the intervening decades, they've learned that those annual inspections aren't necessary. There's hardly any change from one year to the next. And they say, gee, cutting it back to every 2 or 3 years wouldn't compromise safety because whatever they're looking at moves so slowly anyway. If that rationale were presented and defended, fine with me. You know, I don't have any problem with that. And if for members of the general public that don't understand this engineering, I'll explain it easily. It is safer to inspect your tires, all five of them. You know what I mean by five of them? Every time you get in the car, right? Every time you go out in the morning or in the afternoon, it'd be safer if you went around and inspected the tires. None of us do that. None of us even inspect it every time we fill it up.
Well, don't say none of us. There might be one of us here that does.
Every time you go out in the morning?
No, every time I fill up with gas.
Okay. All right.
He does.
Yeah. I understand that.
I don't check my oil.
But I'm not arguing the case. It is generally safe enough, absent any trends, to do it less frequently than every morning when you get out of bed.
Certainly.
And yet, no one would concede that if the effort weren't burdensome, that it would marginally be safer to do it every time. When you drove to the grocery store and then when you went drive back, you should check them again.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, with that as an introduction to the general public's idea of understanding this, there is always some marginal benefit to more inspection, but it's often diminishing returns and almost no extra return at a certain point. And maybe they picked some inspection intervals years ago because they didn't know what we would now know.
But that's correct. The other thing to remember is that the plant performs inspections as well and would report if there's any deviations from the expected behavior. And so the NRC inspections are confirmatory. And then the other point is that we're doing a lot of work to improve our understanding of degradation mechanisms for dry casks. And in some cases, we're backfitting with additional instrumentation. So the reason that I don't inspect my tires every time I get in the car is that there's a little light that goes on if the pressure is low in any one of the tires.
For a new
car. It works really well because for some reason this last 2 years, I picked up about 3 or 4 different nails in the tires, and every single time I learn about it because the light goes on, and I have to go get it repaired.
For a new car, so, Dr. Peterson.
By the way,
car, don't let that.
By the way,
mine is 12 years old. But
No.
I'm in favor.
Yeah. The Honda minivans, they're fantastic. They just keep going and going. You'll never get rid of a minivan because you they just keep going and going.
But you can't. So you can't. You can't. You can't complain about using advanced technology to teach us things we didn't used to know.
Yeah.
But I was trying to explain that it is not necessarily the case that more is always better. Sometimes more doesn't add almost anything.
Which leads me to my second bullet here.
Right.
Thank you for that, Bob.
Go right ahead.
as we know, the Nuclear Energy Institute has come out with their initiative delivering the nuclear promise, and that nuclear plants have, under 70 some of those, I believe, have implemented efficiency bulletins. A good example is preventive maintenance optimization, where they're looking at all their maintenance procedures and time frame frequencies and resolving to improve those, and it generally means less of it. And that's a good example of how the efficiencies are working from the industry's standpoint. Third bullet we've covered, NRC risk-based regulation. We talked a little bit about rotation of resident inspectors, and the two inspectors here they're getting toward the end of their term, which I think is 7 years max, although they could extend it by a year or two possibly. So they're thinking about where they might go next and what might happen.
Well, you know, just I think the agency is facing a potential problem with that. You know, people are aging, they're retiring, they are rotating out. So there is a potential loss of institutional memory. And how does the agency recruit and retain talent? You know, but for this facility, you know, it, in 4 to 5 years, if it ceases to produce power, that would not be an issue. But for the federal agency, they really have to address that problem sooner or later.
They do it by hiring new people in and experienced people in. I don't think both inspectors leave at the same time. I think there's some time difference in that, I would hope. We also talked about NRC facilities. One of the resident inspector we talked to talked about NRC having a lot of facilities which are empty. Apparently they have rent contracts for the space, and they're cutting back on the personnel, leaving empty spaces.
That may be privileged information about the empty buildings.
Strike that from the record. All right, well, that was the inspector we met with. We always like to meet with them. It's a good meeting. So, you know, we talked yesterday.
Just to clarify, the strike it from the record was a joke, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay, good. Okay, just to make sure that we don't for that purpose.
Right? Thank you for that clarification.
And for me, I do not know if this is privileged information or not. You know, when you had a federal agency were perceived to have excessive real estate capacity, that's a sensitive issue. Right, because they are the shepherds of public funds. How did they get into that situation? So who knows?
Who knows? We talked yesterday and saw that nice video about the stator, generator stator refurbishment. And along with that stator, the stator is cooled when it's in operation by hydrogen. The hydrogen is cooled by this stator coil cooling water system, which I've shown up here. And which is a water system with hydrogen cover gas. Because of the stator refurbishment, PG&E took the opportunity to modify the cooling water system to augment its cooling capacity. As they were cutting into the pipe, there was a hydrogen gas ignition. There were no personnel injuries, no fires indicated, no collateral damage, although FME, or the foreign material exclusion blanket, was blown off and a sign was blown down. So they stopped work immediately to see what the situation was. And part of the event evaluation in my last major bullet, they found that the work order didn't contain the proper precautions for flammable gas. It had some, but they're not enough. The standard hydrogen purge, which they'd used many times in the past successfully, they assumed, based on that, that it wouldn't be any problems, but I guess there was more hydrogen left this time than before. And you can see the other two all identified with the potential for flammable gas, the last one for sampling. So based on that, they did these corrective actions. They changed their procedures to include all the things that weren't done adequately the first time. They did some training, counseling of individuals, augmented sampling, which I think is very important, and additional guidance. And we looked through all that. That looked pretty satisfactory to us. Luckily, nobody was hurt and not any damage done.
You know, this event illustrates the difficulty for the committee and for us to evaluate safety significance of events. When you are talking about hydrogen ignition on a nuclear power plant, a red flag would automatically be raised. Now, the dismissal of this event is based on, to me, it's, at least I am persuaded, I'm willing to dismiss it based on the first principle consideration, because the inventory of the hydrogen gas is very limited. You know, they've gone through calculation, also observation. It's very, very limited. So the energy involved is very, very small. And also based on the precursory examination of the physical proximity of safety equipment, then one comes to the conclusion it's of low safety significance or for this event taken in isolation. But the concern is, gee, what happened if you had a larger inventory hydrogen gas? If the same procedural deficiency were to occur, then the consequences would be much different. But we had no gauge, we had no plan, and no, I would say, we had limited resources to expand our inquiry in that direction. And it may not even be fair to the licensee to go down that path. Right? So this really clearly illustrates the complexity and difficulty about making safety assessment for events that appear to be, it's okay.
Well, I don't think they think it was okay. Now, right. There are instances where they deal with larger volumes of hydrogen gas, and that's in the generator itself, because they have a blanket of hydrogen gas in the generator. So when they bleed that out during outages, or like they did for the stator refurbishment, they dealt with a large quantity of hydrogen successfully, if you know what I mean. And so
yes, they did.
They've shown they can handle it. In this case, they just didn't do it quite adequately. So, yeah. I feel pretty comfortable with what they've got here. The corrective action looked right on target to me.
Sure.
And, of course, they'll be sensitive to that next time they do it, because they always, as they do a work order, they pull in any operational experience from previous jobs. So.
Okay.
All right, so that was that. I'm glad it was successfully done. I addressed this already, the 4 kV breaker replacement with the Planned Health Committee, the first item. I'm not going to go over it again, but it just turned out coincidentally that we had this item on our agenda, and the Planned Health Committee just happened to have the 4 kV breaker action plan, so that basically took care of our concerns here. And I mentioned that in my fact-finding report and just basically repeated the Planned Health Committee presentation in this section of the report. So I'm not going to go over it again unless somebody wants to. Finally, in coming out of outage 2R21, the plant is in a shutdown mode and goes through a number of modes. Mode 6 is refueling. The fuel's all out. They're doing refueling. Then it goes to mode 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1, 1 being full power operation. And going from one mode to another, technical specifications require certain equipment has to be in place, certain systems have to be there, and certain procedural requirements have to be met. So following the outage, ops was, they wanted to go from mode 5, which is called cold shutdown, which is a case where the temperature of the reactor cooling system is less than 200 degrees Fahrenheit, to mode 4, where the temperature can get up to 350 degrees Fahrenheit.
And the difference there is that in mode 4, at atmospheric pressure, water boils.
Well, it's under pressure.
What?
It's under pressure.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
But
oh, yeah, it does. 212.
But were there to be a pressure, there wasn't pressure, water would boil, and below that, it isn't.
Hmm. Well, the system is closed. It's pressurized.
Yeah, I understand. I hope it is.
But if you have an accident, where the system is no longer closed, like a large break, then if it's cold, it won't boil. If
right.
It is hot,
yeah.
It's
if an accident releases pressure and it's at cold, the water will not boil.
Correct.
And that changes the dynamics of the whole system a lot in terms of how much time there is to respond and how much water there is and where it goes.
All right, which leads me to the point that to go from mode five to four with an increase in temperature, certain things have to be available to mitigate that.
Yeah, you bet.
Called defense in depth. We've covered that. And so item number two, the bullet there, one of the requirements is the 500 kV off-site power is to be available.
Right.
To power emergency.
In order that it powers the emergency equipment.
Exactly. Right. Well, the 500 kV off-site power was not available at this time. So operations, as per tech specs, requested the probabilistic risk assessment group to perform a risk assessment of going from mode 5 to mode 4 without 500 kV being available. They did a defense-in-depth study, safety study, based on probabilistic risk assessment principles for AC power, and they determined that the risk color was green. And why was that? And I'll show a chart in just a minute. Because all the emergency diesel generators were operable, emergency power, and instead of 500 kV power, they had the 230 kV power, off-site power available in its place. So they really met all the requirements, just with 230 kV versus 500 kV power.
But what was written down required the 500.
Or the equivalent.
And the 230 was the equivalent.
It's a backup emergency power system, yeah.
Right. Now, we were satisfied with this approach. You know, this is basically a quasi-deterministic approach. You look at available sources for power. You had all the diesels, and you had a somewhat equivalent 230 kV volt offside power, although you did not have the 500 kV, right? So it's really among three possible sources of availability, they only lost one. So based on that, you know, one can come to that conclusion.
There was plenty of backup in the
right. Words, yeah. Right. Without addressing any reliability numbers, you know. There's no need to go there. So we were persuaded.
Yeah. And this logic chart shows the steps they went through from left to right. And you can see on the right-hand side there are two green blocks. And those branches show that either of those situations, I know it's hard to read, they could follow either of those with various equipment in place. And green means good. Green means you have all your defense in depth in place, which means in Diablo's case, and most every other plant too, that you have the number of components available plus one. So you covered minimum plus one additional component in place. So the green here is what permitted the change from mode 5 to mode 4, and it was done successfully.
And for the uninitiated who might be watching this remotely or reading it later, up is yes, good, okay, available, and down is no, not available.
Right.
Yep.
Right. That's exactly right.
That's how you go through this diagram.
Right. That's exactly right.
And that concludes my report. And I would ask, I sent this out to Peter first for comments, and then the committee. I've gotten comments back, and the report I've sent you recently has the comments built into it, so it's ready for consideration.
Great.
For
now,
approval.
If I may add some remark, Mr. Waddell, looking at the agenda for this fact-finding meeting, let me share with you how Mr. Waddell and I came up with this agenda. One, the items were selected from the open item list, consistent with the committee's priority and timeliness. Two, we exclude items that appear to be repetitive. If Dr. Peterson or Dr. Butner had examined the item recently, we would not have selected them. And three, we allow for some item to be timely, such as a hydrogen gas ignition. And then four is whatever new items that we thought worthy of further inquiry. Right, so the focus here is that we really do not have idle curiosities. So it's been a careful process of selecting them. Okay. That said, opening up for committee bench comments. Dr. Peterson, Dr. Butness. Okay.
No, it was. I want to remark that the written report was excellent, and that's a common experience with both Furman and Rick, and it's nice to report that again.
Okay. Let's entertain public comments on the report. Ms. Lewis?
Yes, that's right. Sherry Lewis with Mothers for Peace. I just have a simple question. Why was it that the NRC decided it wanted to become more efficient? Was it a political thing or not?
No, it's actually direction from Congress. And so NRC, basically, because we have government, the governance is that the NRC is required to do the things that Congress tells it. And Congress provides direction to the NRC on what it should prioritize in appropriations bills. So it's direction from Congress.
Do you know when this was?
Oh, a few years ago.
Basically, Congress has wanted to cut budgets on everything.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So even though this one, the 90% of the costs of the NRC's operations are recovered from fees on licensees. Which is okay. FDA at 60%. So the FDA actually does a lot more things that are arguably in.
Is that right? FDA is only 60%.
It's very different. So FDA has capability to waive fees across a much wider range of things, such as orphan drug studies and things of that nature.
NRC wasn't singled out in this initiative. There was a general thought in the Congress, which is sensible, that if you don't look at your activities and goes on for a long, 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 long time, you're going to find some things you're doing just because you always did them that aren't necessarily justified in the way they were. I mean, it's sort of a sensible relook.
Right.
But with a safety mission, the key has always been to make sure that you don't cut back on the safety side. And that's the flip side of it.
Right. And to be fair, Ms. Lewis, to be fair to the United States Congress, the NRC is the most technical federal agency there is.
Maybe. I kind of think the FAA is pretty technical.
Right. But if you look at collectively how many technical staff
they have, I think the FDA is pretty technical.
Well, Dr. Butness.
I think that we're veering off into a path of discussion that is delaying us from getting any lunch.
Right. But if I may finish my remark, the agency has for years focused on efficiency and risk-based and risk-informed regulations. So it is pretty consistent with what they were trying to do. I mean, this is no surprise to me, you know, knowing how they functioned in the past. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for your remarks. And if there are no additional public comments, do I have a motion to approve the report? Submitted.
Yeah, I'll move to.
I second.
Okay.
But my motion is to accept the report.
To accept and approve. Okay.
I'll second it.
It's a different word, but that's the right word.
That's the right word.
And once it passes, this will become part of the public record and the committee's annual report.
All right. So according to Dr. Bunner's motion, let's vote.
Aye.
Aye. So the motion carried. The report is now accepted. Okay, it's time for lunch. Let's reconvene exactly at 1:30.
Oh, no, 1 o'clock.
Not according to our agenda. We had only one item to be addressed. A published agenda is at 1:30.
Oh, no. Oh, sorry. You're correct. Yes, okay. We reconvene at 1:30.
Right, we reconvene at 1:30.
Very good. Thank you. Good catch.
Okay, thank you.
Once we're dead...
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The time is 1:30. Let us reconvene for the afternoon session of the second day of the 95th public meetings of the D.A. Buchanan Independent Safety Committee. The first item on our agenda is committee members' remarks. Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butners, there being none, the next item is for public comments on item not on our agenda. Any members of the public who wishes to address the committee on matters of their concern not on the committee's agenda, please come forward to the podium. There being none, the next item on our agenda is informational presentation requested by the committee of PG&E. Now, may I turn the podium over to Mr. Tom Baldwin, Director of Business Planning.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. Here to speak with us about the Diablo Canyon Performance Improvement Program, we have Ann Shatara, who's got more than 20 years of experience in the nuclear industry. She comes to us with a master's degree in nuclear engineering from University of Tennessee and has a good experience at Diablo Canyon in engineering, rad protection, and performance improvement for many years. Ann?
Welcome.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. As Tom said, my name is Ann Shatara, and I'm currently the Performance Improvement Manager at Diablo Canyon. Been in that position for 2 years as manager and 9 years as supervisor prior to that. So this afternoon, I'm going to speak with you a little bit about the Performance Improvement Program at the plant and a little bit about how we use it there.
Great.
So this is the performance improvement model. It's shown as a closed cycle because in nuclear, if you're not improving, you're sliding backwards. So we're constantly looking, learning, and improving, or as represented on this model, we're finding issues, we're analyzing them, and then we are fixing them. There's a number of programs in our suite that we use to do so, and through the course of this presentation, I'll go through them and give you some insight in how they have been used over the last year.
Great.
So the first one listed is the Corrective Action Program. We commonly refer to it as CAP. It is the foundation of everything that we do at the station. Without CAP, performance improvement would not function. It provides an avenue for employees to identify issues, document our evaluations and the results, as well as provide a repository for internal operating experience for us to refer to as we've continued operation throughout the years. Self-assessment is a unique program where staff employees can compare current operation or how we are performing to what the standard says. So what does the procedure say, and is that what we are actually doing? To identify any gaps prior to someone else coming in and identifying that for us, or to help identify areas where we know we're struggling in performance, but we're not quite sure why or how. Benchmarking is when we ask others what they do and how they do it so that we can learn from them. This can be done over the telephone, just phone a friend, or an email survey, or physically taking a trip somewhere and documenting what you find. Operating experience is one of the most unique things about the nuclear industry. Our federal regulator tells us we have to share our challenges with others. Yeah. You are required to do so. I don't think... Yes, Per.
Actually, that it's an interesting question whether it emerged from regulation or whether it was
something that the industry did post TMI voluntarily, because the primary way by which OE is shared between plants and benchmarking is organized, I think, is via INPO. INPO was created
as a result,
and so in some sense, I don't know whether this is an industry-initiated response or whether it was a regulatory requirement that plants share this information in the way they do.
It was both, and it was almost simultaneously. Ah. The NRC established its own office called AOD, the Analysis and Evaluation of Operational Data, and required reporting almost simultaneously with the founding of INPO. And that was in the first year after TMI.
Okay. In that case, then, it does sound like it's a regulatory requirement, but the interesting point is that it's also very much in the interest of utilities to share this kind of information. It's in everybody's benefit. This is an area where working collaboratively is a lot more sensible than not working collaboratively.
Definitely. But it's not something that you see commonly. So Apple is not going to share what they find when they're developing new things with Microsoft.
You know, that was an issue. Let me describe. PG&E doesn't compete with Commonwealth Edison, now Exelon. No.
True.
Because they're both regulated utilities. And so on the utility operator side, that competition was not a barrier. But I don't have to tell you that, of course, Westinghouse was competing with GE.
Yes.
And they still do. Mm-hmm. So that was a barrier that had to be overcome. And it was overcome by an NRC regulation that then was about to be protested when Congress stepped in and just did it. Okay? That precedent was already there with the aircraft earlier. Mm-hmm. Boeing was always competing with McDonnell Douglas, but they were sharing. So that was understood to be something that was necessary. Okay? I mean, I'm old enough to tell you I was there, and we were watching that, and it came out the way we wanted, okay?
And we're all safer.
By the way, it's fair enough. GE and Westinghouse wanted to share with each other, the technical people, mm-hmm. but the lawyers were in the way. I mean, you understand. And the lawyers weren't wrong or evil. It was just that they had certain issues with which to deal that were overridden by the federal authority at the time. And that's fair enough.
So, Bob, back when the utilities were looking at deregulation in the 90s, I know when I was at the Duke, nuclear plants shared a lot of stuff back in the old regulated days. But as deregulation came along, we kept asking ourselves, now, do we at Duke want to share with PG&E? Although we don't compete directly with them, if we're competing, or even neighboring utilities, perhaps South Carolina. So that question came up about do we continue sharing? Mm-hmm. Or not. It turned out there wasn't enough deregulation to take place to make much of a difference, at least down our way.
Yeah. But you're going to tell us, and it's true, that today this sharing is universal.
Yes.
And we're all the better for it.
Yes.
I know that. You were about to say that, or if you didn't already say it, so go say it.
Okay. So, yes, we are all better for it, and it continues. We're all safer for it. We also have our internal operating experience, which I said is captured in our corrective action program. So if a pump is not, it fails, and then 20 years later it fails again, we have the opportunity to go back in our system to see what were the corrective actions that we took to address it last time. If things are repeating to fail on the same piece of equipment, we can look for trends on that as well. I'm going to skip over monitoring and trending and human performance and go to field engagement and coaching. Field engagement and coaching is an opportunity that the leaders have to get out into the field and not only talk to and inquire with their own employees, but also talk to and ask about and turn into dialogue with employees that from a different group. So if I specialize or oversee those in operations, I'd go and talk to those in maintenance. And ask them what are their barriers or challenges that they're having so I can help them break those down and work through anything that they have, which helps them do their job more safely and effectively. All that information is gathered and documented into a database so it can be reviewed, not only by the leader of that line, but across lines to see if we have any issues that are common. And that goes into performance monitoring and trending. So we've got all this data coming in from these various methodologies, and they're all documented in one or two different places. We look at them on an ongoing basis to see what do we need to address. And one of the ways that we do this is through our human performance tools. As we all know, humans are fallible. We make mistakes. But we need to ask questions as to why did that take place, and are there things we can put into place to minimize those mistakes, especially the consequential ones, the more significant ones. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later on. So CAP, we have about 20,000 issues that are identified on an annual basis. They go into a system, a computer system. A lot of individuals think of it as a black box, but within that black box, there are a number of reviews that take place. The item is risk ranked. It's assigned a significance level, a type of evaluation. Corrective actions come out of it. Senior leadership reviews it. We take action. We document that action. And then we close that item. Upon closure, the individual that initiated the item is given an email that says, hey, the item that you submitted has been closed, which gives them the opportunity to then go in and see what was done about it. So it's not you're just flinging something out there and they're like, did they work on it? Did they not work on it? You have an opportunity to look to see. And we have tools in place like the email that facilitates that.
Now, based on what you had indicated so far, it appears to me that a great deal of analysis and evaluation is being conducted by your staff. As a background, would you tell us a little bit briefly about the technical expertise and credential of your staff so that we had a better comprehension about what is going on?
Actually, my staff isn't the ones doing all of the evaluations.
Okay.
So it's the subject matter experts, which are often in other parts of the station. So you've got your engineers, your maintenance craft, your operators. We help facilitate the processes. We aren't the subject matter experts with all of the technical knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So you are basically an administrator of information, well, a coordinator.
It's more than that, but they don't pretend to have the domain expertise everywhere.
Correct.
Oh, no, nobody does, right?
No, but but it's more than an administrative task for these people.
Right, so then maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the credential and background of your staff, who is, I don't want to use the word administrator, as Dr. Butner said, it is more than administration, who is coordinating these efforts. Who are these technical staff, and where do they come from?
So I have a staff of approximately 10 individuals in various roles, and they have some of them are degreed, some of them are not degreed. They've been at the station anywhere from 5 years to 30 years. They all have the cause evaluation qualification.
Right.
So they've gone through a qualification process for that. They are all very well versed in our programs and our procedures, and they are the subject matter experts on our programs and our procedures in the performance improvement area. And they know who to go to for the subject matter expertise. So they help with that, as well as helping to document for easy reading.
Uh-huh. So they, in a sense, administer, develop, and implement, and enforce, perhaps, procedural matters essential to the program.
Yes.
Is that a good description?
I would, yes, concur with that.
Okay.
I still think that there's more to it than that. If they didn't, either individually or, of course, among their colleagues, have a technical background and understanding, they wouldn't have been able to do the rest of it. Okay, so I'm going to say this again. I'm saying technical, and he's saying administrative, and I'm saying technical again, and he's saying administrative again.
No.
I'm keeping to come back to the technical.
I am just asking. I have no knowledge as to what technical detail, you know, Ms. Shatara's staff is engaging.
Well, I
so my inquiry, you know, it's exploratory, and I have no preconceived notions of what are the appropriate.
Well, so let me take a whack at it, and you can tell me whether I got it wrong.
Okay.
For many of those issues, she and her staff can disposition them without further reference to a technical expert, although you send it around after you've done that to make sure. And for another percentage of them, you just can't without going to the technical expert at first.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an important fraction for which you and your staff can do that directly. Of course, you check later.
Yep.
Because you not only have the technical knowledge and experience, but the issue itself is transparently either not difficult or not controversial.
I would concur with that.
Okay.
Oh, yes, indeed. No, there's no dispute there. Furthermore, you know, my labeling of the word of administrator, it's not derogatory. To me, administrating a program as essential as your CAP program.
I agree.
It's important work. I mean, you know, as you say, you know, they may be degree individual or non-degree individual. You know, that is a piece of information I take notice. But more importantly, it's that capability and experience and motivation would matter, would, you know, be a matter of importance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, I think enough said.
Go ahead.
Right. Enough said. Please go on.
Okay. So when we look at evaluations, we have three different types of hierarchy, the most significant being our root cause evaluations. All of those root causes are reviewed against a standard that's outlined by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They come in every 2 years and take a look at those. Then we have our cause evaluations. Again, everyone on my staff is cause evaluator qualified, and they pair up with the author of those if they do not author them themselves. And then there's the work group evaluation, which is the vast majority of the evaluation types that we perform at the station.
Sure. Sure.
So, Anne, with these evaluations, where does troubleshooting fit in?
Troubleshooting? So troubleshooting probably wouldn't even be here. It's before you even get here. So if you're troubleshooting an equipment, you haven't gotten here yet.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. What I thought.
Okay, that's fair enough.
So in 2019, we performed 43 documented self-assessments. Self-assessment is a tool that can be used to both identify an issue as well as come up with a solution to an identified already issue. So while the bubbles on the PI model that I showed you at the beginning were very discrete, the tools can fall into more than one area, and self-assessment happens to be one of them. We usually identify a specific topic that we want to go after for a self-assessment, such as implementation against a specific procedure. And then we will walk through over the course of a week or 2 weeks how we are doing to implement that procedure through document reviews, through interviews, and small groups. We'll roll that up and identify where we are challenged and make recommendations on how to resolve that.
Now, what you've just described, 43, they're formal structured self-assessments.
Correct.
And that's a particular defined activity.
Correct.
Now, besides that, there's a lot of self-assessment that goes on in an informal way that isn't part of this, of course.
Correct.
Right.
Yes.
So these are things that you monitor, right, among many other self-assessments.
Yeah, they're structured and they're formal.
Yeah. Yes.
And they get followed and documented and reviewed and all that stuff.
Yes.
So, Anne, am I correct? There are assessments and there are self-assessments. Assessments would be something you might do on other groups, whereas a self-assessment my group might do on itself. Is that generally the case?
So my group wouldn't perform the other type of assessment. That would be like Ken Cortez's group.
Oh, QV.
Quality group would perform that type of assessment.
But sure. Self-assessments, the mechanical engineering group would do one on their own group,
yes.
Correct? Now, so my question is, do they do those willingly, or do they drag their feet to have to do them? Because back in my day, we used to hate to do self-assessments.
Right.
I'm just wondering how that happens.
It kind of depends. My team's getting ready for a pre-PINR, so problem identification and resolution self-assessment at the end of February. While it's not the most fun activity, we do it in advance of a known regulatory inspection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the calendar. We've known about it for 9 months, and we're going to do it, and we're going to have the support that we need to perform it. When someone else tells you have to do it, you're not going to want to do it, like almost anything. A lot of the PI tools, not a lot of people are, I mean, they're not fun.
No, they're not.
But when people get results and they buy into the results and then they see performance improve, they appreciate that they went through the work to
All
get
right,
there.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So benchmarking, like I said, we benchmark ourselves. We benchmark other aspects of PG&E. We benchmark other nuclear facilities, and we're also benchmarking other industries. Mm-hmm. And again, these are documented formal benchmark activities. These are most likely the ones that we physically traveled to. Not the, though a benchmark is you're calling your peer at another station and documenting it. You're performing a survey or an industry poll and documenting that as well. How do you perform this activity? What is your experience with X? This is my challenge. Did you run into this? How did you resolve it?
Now, you know, this benchmarking, it's an important endeavor. Who would be doing the benchmarking? It's your staff getting assistance from other group in performing the benchmarking?
So it's actually, it's not my staff that would necessarily perform the benchmarking unless we're looking to improve one of our own programs.
Uh-huh.
So it would be maintenance, ops, engineering, whatever group or line organization has the challenge that they're looking to get a change on or improvement on.
So your staff would provide guidance or guideline or schedule a suggestion to whoever doing the benchmark?
Right. So we can provide guidance on who they should call, if they need help identifying someone to call or a plant to visit. We can reach out to IMPO and ask them who's the best at X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm. Because
if they're interested.
Right, this is not a trivial exercise. You know, when you ask
correct.
Someone to do
if you're going to travel someplace, that would be correct. We also have a number of working groups that we participate in, and so we facilitate the surveys. So engineering came to me, for example, yesterday and said, I need to send out this survey. Can you help me facilitate that? So I worked with the manager. We wrote the question down, and then I can send it out to all of my peers who will then share it with their engineering counterparts, and we can collect the data for them.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
So we're facilitators.
Yes, indeed. Uh-huh. I'm sure that's a better label Dr. Butners would agree to, right? Dr. Butners doesn't like administrators, but facilitator.
Yeah, he might like a facilitator.
Well, I wasn't arguing the case. I was just trying to emphasize that without the technical knowledge, you couldn't be effective.
Oh, that's for sure, right? Right, yeah, right. Well, no, that is for sure, right? Ms. Yeah. Shantano's staff must have some technical knowledge. Otherwise, you know, I mean, it's not doable.
I would agree.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, please go on.
So operating experience, we've already talked about quite a bit. In 2019, we screened 638 items from across the U.S., as well as some of them were international. So IMPO does facilitate significant nuclear industry events that have taken place outside of North America as well.
Sure.
We have, as I've already gone through, a significant amount of information that my team has available to them. Some of it's daily, weekly, quarterly, monthly, which we are looking at all the time to identify themes, trends, where do we need to put a little more attention to, where do we need to do an evaluation, a formal evaluation, where may we do a self-assessment, where could we do a benchmark to try to improve or change a process to really move the dial in our performance at the station.
So, Ann,
yes,
we were looking yesterday through our open items list and ran across a meeting called Performance Review Quarterly Meeting that we used to go to. Do you still have those?
We do. We had it last week, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So in that meeting, we're looking at our performance through the lens of metrics.
Okay.
So it's very metric-driven. All the managers and directors will get together in a room and review selected metrics and then any other metrics in a compiled book.
Hmm. Okay. Is that any particular week during the quarter, or is it in other words, we'd probably like to observe one coming up sometime this year.
Okay.
At a fact-finding meeting, and don't know when exactly to...
I know they're scheduled for this year. I don't recall off the top of my head. We can follow up with you.
If you get that to Hector, he could get it to us.
I'm sure Hector can...
Yep.
Yeah, we can get that to you.
Thank you.
So performance monitoring training. Human performance. So human performance, humans make mistakes. It happens. January 1 rolls around, you go to write the date on a piece of paper, and you write 2019 instead of 2020. It happens. We've all been there, right? We have three tiers of human performance errors or at the plant. Very much like a safety pyramid where the top is a fatality, it's the most consequential. And at the bottom would be, and that's a station level event, at the bottom would be something more analogous to a slip or a trip. You don't hurt yourself, but maybe you pull a muscle, you ice it for a little bit. That we call an organizational learning opportunity, which is, and that's what it is. We treat that as, let's see what happened, what can we learn from it, what can we share, so that we don't go further up that pyramid. The middle band is called a department-level event. We don't want department-level events. We don't want station-level events. Having organizational learning events, it's our opportunities. Though it is a count, if we're learning from them, if we're sharing them, if we're taking action on those learnings, having lots of them isn't necessarily a bad thing because we're improving. It also means that we have a low level of reporting, which speaks to a very high safety culture and a speak-up culture.
So, Ann, we meet with the NRC on each of our fact-finding meetings. Just mm-hmm. compare notes. A couple of months ago, we were sitting down with, I can't remember whether it was John Reynoso or Chris Newport, one of them, and asked him, you know, what are you looking at and what are you finding? And well, they mentioned what they perceived as an increase in low-level human performance events.
Yes.
I was see if you could address that for us, if you would.
So, and my team has identified the same thing. We have had a slight uptick. So to give you some context, if you go back to 2012 or so, we had approximately 50 department-level events that year. And again, that's the middle. When you look at 2017, 2018, 2019, you're down in less than five. So the criteria didn't change. The behaviors of the individuals did change. So they improved.
So you see an order of magnitude reduction in a decade?
Yes, since 2012. However, I'm going to put a caveat on there. Like I began with, excellence means you're always improving, and if you don't, you're sliding backwards. We're constantly raising the bar. And this means that what was acceptable in 2012 as good performance is not acceptable now. So we have seen some challenges with human performance. The NRC is seeing some challenges with human performance, and we are addressing it through very targeted action plans. And doing evaluations on those organizational learning opportunities. So one of the things that we're doing is looking at when one takes place, whether it's in ops or maintenance or security, asking questions like, how is today different than any other day? Was the employee that was involved in this incident, were they distracted? Because they're going on vacation tomorrow and they're thinking about a tropical island. And they missed a step in the procedure. Or is there a light bulb burnt out over their location and they didn't put a headlamp on and we didn't fix it? What is different that led to this event? And it's the employee, it's the work environment, it's leadership. Where were the downfalls? Once we identify those and do the evaluation, we share that, not just with that group, that little crew of five, or that department, but we share it with the station so we all can look at what do I have similar in my work environment that I could take action on to improve.
So has the uptick leveled off or downtick leveled off, or the low level? Where do we stand?
So we closed out 2019. Let's see. We had one event in December that I believe either Hossein or Ken spoke to earlier, where an inadvertent entry into a tech spec. And that was our last significant event. Okay. But we're still looking at all of our organizational learning opportunities and anything else. Every time we get a new data point, we're still evaluating what else can we do. Operations has been challenged in a few areas in the last 6 months, and NRC is looking at that. And we've been paired up. The individual in my organization that helps operations has been right next to the ops manager and director to help identify different avenues to address those areas and those concerns.
Okay, thanks.
So let's see. So one of the areas that we continue to be challenged with over the last year has been procedure use and adherence. When you look at our violations from the NRC and our organizational learning opportunities, procedure use and adherence is a common theme. In the nuclear industry, everything has a procedure. Can't do anything without a procedure. A lot of the procedures, they're analogous to you go to build, you get a new barbecue, and you're going to go build it. If you don't read it before you start the work, you could miss a step. Or misinterpret a step. I'm pretty sure your neighbor also built the barbecue, and maybe he understood something differently than you did, or he has made some suggestions, but they didn't incorporate that into the instructions. So you could do it, have a better list of instructions if they hadn't taken your feedback. So we're constantly looking at our procedures. We're constantly looking at, can we revise them? Can we improve them? Is there clarity that needs to be added? Also recall, we've been in operation for a number of years. What may have been really clear to some of our employees 10 years ago may not be read the same way as our current employees. So we're using different ways of getting that information out after every event so that we can continue to improve. Field engagement and coaching. Coaching, when you think of coaching, you think of, let's see, you're on a sports team and there's someone on the sideline yelling at you to do something better. Improve, run laps, do something like that. So it's more of engagement. Engagement has that connotation of sharing. It's more collegial. So that's what our leaders are taught to do now. This isn't I'm going to drive by, I'm going to coach you to do better, and then I'm going to move on and document it. Instead, this is I'm going to come in, and you're not going to be all shaking and scared because I'm over your shoulder and I'm going to give you so many demerits. I'm here to help, and I want to find out from you what's working, what isn't working, so I know how to be a better leader for you so I can make your job easier.
Right.
We take the PI team, my team, looks at that data to try to figure out where can we advise the station and the station leadership to improve different things, if it's just department specific or if it's station specific. It also helps with employee engagement in general, breaking down barriers between different levels of leadership and employees. So this is just a recap of how we did last year, things that were performed. For OE, we did share 57 events with the industry, things that took place at the station.
Oh, so those 57 are OE that you sent out?
Yes. They were incoming to another station.
Yeah.
And they usually had a cause evaluation attached to it.
I understand.
And that's just a quick summary of all of the tools. Again, these are all just tools for helping us find, analyze, and fix challenges and issues that we have so that we're continually improving and not sliding backwards. And that's all I've got.
Go back to that one last.
Sure.
I'm just reading the numbers of events continues to improve. There's always the tension between you have fewer numbers of whatever because less things are happening, or you're having fewer numbers because they're not reporting them.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Everybody understands that mm-hmm. tension.
Yes.
Can you describe programs that you have or whatever that help you differentiate between which of those it is?
So we constantly monitor the number of notifications that are written. That's our CAP, our corrective action program. Mm-hmm. So us and the NRC are looking at that. Are people identifying things of all levels of significance? And has that changed over the years? That's one way we look at it. We also look at, we have an anonymous notification process. So do you want to raise an issue and not be self-identified? We'll look at that program as well to see, are things being entered regardless? And then the organizational learning opportunities again. Are people bringing up low threshold items, if they are self-disclosing things. Did I do something that I know I wasn't supposed to do or that happened and there's no one around? Did I say something or did I not say something? If I said something, that's an indication that the threshold is low and people are still reporting. It's just not a significant event. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Well, a question. Does the employee concerns program report to you?
No.
Is that part of, okay. What
employee
is that?
Employee concerns reports directly to Jim Welsh.
Jim Welsh, okay.
Yes.
Justifiably so, right?
Yes.
Right, so it goes to the top.
That's true everywhere. It's part of the setup to be that way. It's like QA has to report to them too.
Yes.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. That's a good way to do it.
I understand
comments,
that.
Comments from the committee's bench to this excellent presentation.
It was very helpful. Good for you.
Let's entertain public comments. There being none, you know, thank you to our...
No, he's got a comment.
Oh, do we have a public comments? Yeah. Oh, please come to the podium.
This was the last presentation.
Yes, it is.
It's possibly the most important.
May I ask you to please introduce yourself?
My name is Tom Murray, Apple Beach.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm representing myself.
Sure.
The point I'm going to make is this is the last presentation of this meeting, and it's possibly the most important.
Yes, it's among the most important, absolutely.
You know, it's quite humble and all that kind of stuff, and it's easily lost. What we're getting down to is the morale of the staff.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, it's the people who make it happen. From Mr. Welsh down to someone who sweeps the floor. And we've got a situation here. It's when you put it down on paper, it's really startling. We've got a plant that's being decommissioned, okay. The licensee, the owner, is in bankruptcy right now. Hopefully that's going to be straightened out, but that's where they are. And they certainly don't have this lily-white record of never dealing in bad faith. I mean, if you guys have been following the Wall Street Journal, I'm sure, and you've seen these articles of nefarious behavior, stemming back to falsifying records to San Bruno and stuff to the PUC. And now we have a presentation that is basically about morale. I'm just making the comments so it's not lost on you guys, and I don't think it is. That's it. That's all I have to say, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your
remarks. And thank you, gentlemen.
And thanks for your comment.
Thank you. Any additional comments from members of the public? There being none, let us thank the speaker for her excellent presentation again and turn our attention to the next item of our agenda.
We don't have to apologize for being last. Something has to be last. and by the way, it's a common experience here that on the second afternoon, attendance is weak because it's just human nature.
Well, there may be additional...
It's not, it wasn't because of the topic, okay?
Well, there may be additional members.
Besides which...
Online, Dr.
I want to tell... Yeah, people watch online. People can come next week and watch again, and they do, okay? So it's not just us.
Right, we have public participation online as well, okay? So now let us turn to the last item on our agenda.
Yes, thanks, Greg.
I believe all of them has been taken care of. But remind me, committee members and our council, I see three items on this list. One is future actions by the committee. I believe we had conducted that part of the business yesterday.
Well, except we want to make sure that we got feedback from Hector Garcia about some plans that we had made, and perhaps he's already done that, to make sure, you know, we picked a date, and we want to make sure that there's not a conflict and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we'll get back to DCISC on the dates that they selected for future fact findings in the public meeting, and I'll do that by the end of the week.
Great, great. So you would convey that message to the council.
Yeah, I mean, sure. That's one of his action items.
Okay, great, great. And then the second one is further information to obtain the review. I believe that item has also been taken care of. The third one is scheduling of future site visits and meetings. I believe that has been taken care of. Okay, that being the case, then before I adjourn this meeting, now we open the floor for members, committee members, concluding remarks.
Yeah, I have one under that, scheduling of future activities. About a year ago, we had a lot of active engagement with the Diablo Canyon, the community, the engagement panel for the decommissioning activities. They came here. We all went to one of their meetings. They invited me back representing the group to make a presentation. And I want to ask whether any of us has had any interactions with them in the interim, or whether that's in abeyance, or whether we're expecting to hear from them, or there's more for us to do, or maybe not.
Maybe we should ask
anybody,
Mr. Ballman's comment.
Well, I was just going to start with the panel here and ask if there's any of us at the table that have had any interaction with them in the last half a year. I haven't, even though we had several back and forth with them a year and a half ago. Anybody else?
No.
I kind of thought not, or because if it had happened, we would have told each other.
Yes, indeed. It would be a reportable event to the committee during our public meetings. But Mr. Borman, any latest update on the engagement panel's activity?
To be honest, I do not oversee or participate with the engagement panel. The decommissioning organization does. I'm most associated with the operating plant. We've got a separate organization such as the operating plant, and the staff there focuses on the station, whereas decommissioning, longer-term planning, and project management type activities are conducted elsewhere.
I would have thought that, you know, putting you on the spot, you're just doing something else, which is important. So I'm not suggesting that we reach out and say, hey, we haven't heard from you all. Maybe one of us ought to go to their website, and I can do it soon, see what they're doing and see if there are any meetings that are of interest to us or something.
Excellent, excellent suggestion, Dr. Butness. You know, to my awareness, the last time the committee made contact was you went down there, gave them a spellbinding presentation, quote unquote. Well, that's the feedback I got from them.
Well, I don't know that.
I don't even recall the subject matter. Was it on seismic risk or the CAS storage? I don't recall.
Neither. It was explaining what we do, and explaining how what we do could be of benefit to them.
Okay, because the feedback I got was from an engagement panel member who had attended your presentation. But that said, you know, this is an excellent suggestion. You know, it is a panel that their activity we had interest in. Yeah. So, okay. So either you, Dr. Butness, or whoever. Okay. So now it's concluding remark from members of the committee, Dr. Peterson. Okay.
Well, yeah, so I have one more thing to report to the public, which never came up here. It has to do with what the so-called IPRP. 15 years ago or so, the state of California appointed a committee under the PUC, or maybe the PUC appointed it with state cooperation, that's called the Independent Peer Review Panel for Seismic Safety. The IPRP, and its members consist of government employees from several agencies. Like there's one member from the Cal State Survey, the Geological Survey. And there's another member from Caltrans, and another one from the Energy Commission. And there's a fellow from the local county. Each of them is a seismologist, and their scope has been to review the seismology program under the PG&E broader safety program and report about it. And they hold periodic meetings. And I went to one recently. I've been trying to attend them all, and I pretty much attend them all. And I just wanted to report that to the public, that anybody in the public can go to them. They're announced on the website broadly. And the result was the IPRP group were broadly strong in their positive endorsement of PG&E's program. Okay, I just want to report that. That's sort of a new subject, but it's worth just saying briefly. It's no secret to anybody in the nuclear industry that PG&E's seismology team, their geosciences program generally, is the gold standard in the industry, not just in the U.S. but around the world. There's no utility that has anything like the strength that PG&E has in that area. And it not only supports the nuclear plant, it supports the rest of the company in the seismic area. And crucially, the company pledged to the public and are carrying through that they would support that group at its full strength until it was not necessary anymore to assure the safety of this station. They made that pledge in public right after the shutdown agreement. And so far, every year, the budget's been sustained. That is, there has been no decrease in that budget. And that's a very, very positive report. But secondly, and then I'm done. I just have one more sentence. The IPRP reviews the technical elements of the program, the technical details in which they are doing either studies or analysis or making measurements and stuff. And they continue to endorse it as being at the forefront of seismic science. Okay? And you know what? Isn't that nice? Okay? Isn't that nice? The forefront meaning that the people on that staff and in that group are doing among the most important advanced work in understanding seismology of any group around. And they're emulated. They're benchmarked against. And they're seen as the leading group anywhere. And I learned that in part by this IPRP review because these are a bunch of seismologists. Okay? That's the end of that report.
Thank you, Dr. Bennis. Dr. Peterson, your remarks? Okay, there being no additional committee members' remark, before I adjourn this meeting.
I have one comment, Mr. Chairman, if the consultants have any remarks. But I just want to make one comment and sure. For the record that our next meeting is going to be here in this room on July 1st and 2nd, 2020. And I just went on to the D.C. engagement panel website, and they do have a meeting coming up. Looks like March 11th at the County Government Center, and that is to discuss the topic of CEQA and the Coastal Act, California Coastal Act. And there's another meeting then in June 24th, a week before our meeting, and that is also at the Government Center to discuss the topic of transportation.
Okay, well, probably the first one is probably a little outside our remit.
Yes.
And the second one, depending on what they touch on, it may or may not be.
Right. And I did want to make one recognition. I wanted to recognize Jess and Riley from AGP Video, particularly this time because you guys did a great job in securing this cabling. I mean, because sometimes I kind of worry when I see
people
trip over it. And you guys did a great job this time. And also I like the skirts on the cameras. And it's really you did an excellent job of making the room safe, which is very important. And the last thing I'll mention is that for everyone, tomorrow is Valentine's Day. So you
know.
Remember for your spouse or significant other.
Right. If I don't get a Valentine from my granddaughter, I'll be disappointed.
We've talked about issues of morale. So it could apply close to home.
Well, thank you, counsel, for your remark. And let me also solicit any comments from the committee bench, including our two senior technical consultants.
So I do have all coming early on my action. I verified all the future fact-finding and public meeting dates, and they're acceptable to PG&E.
Okay, so thank you. So on behalf of the committee, let me again express our appreciation to PG&E's senior management, specifically Director Tom Baumann and Manager Hector Casillas, for your assistance provided to the committee during these 2 days of meeting, and also express appreciation to members of the public who participate in this meeting and also to those who had watched our proceedings online. And also repeating our council's appreciation to our technical audio and video team. That said, now I adjourn the 95th public meeting of the Dearborn Canyon Independent Safety Committee.